website. How many of you are participating in the virtual camping game that we're doing right now? Raise your hands. Okay. Alright. How many of you are on the website? Doug's moderating. He's a big help on that. Okay. I just want to get your comments. How many of you have been reading what's going on in the virtual camp game? Has that been interesting? It's been helpful?
Yeah.
Well, when teaching, in all the lectures, teaching like this, and I've taught Sunday school a lot, but the best way to learn something is what?
Do it.
To do it. Well, they discourage that from learning about sin. They really do. And so, there's a few other things, that's really hard to do. Skydiving is not, encouraged a lot. So how do you do a camp, a winter camp, and organize, with families and things along this line? And so the next best thing is to role play. So we decided it was kind of like the spur of the thing. Let's try a role play game. Role play like the society's falling apart, and they're going to start mass inoculations, forced inoculations, and we got about 2 weeks' notice. We're all going to, somebody's donated some 1,000 acres of land, and we're going up there. And what would it be like? Okay, so we picked a fictitious place, and we made up fictitious names, kind of stuff like that. We're starting our second week. Now, I tell you, people were coming, and it's already interesting. They were brought up things that we hadn't even thought of before. For example, what would be the minimum thing you would have? And we had a suggestion list of things we should have. For example, we said, all right, we're going to start it and leave last Saturday, and kind of stuff. So we're gathering. We send the trucks out to gather everybody. Supposedly, all these virtual or fictitious families are up there. And the first thing we said, all right, we got to get organized. And then somebody said, winter's here. We better go get some wood. And so the next question somebody, is, well, who brought chainsaws? Okay. Who brought chainsaws? And we're just preparing, on their honor, say, what do you have in your food storage or, in your camping and stuff like that? And it's going to be interesting because every week we're going to have a new scenario, a little problem come up. We have two problems. We've got to go get some wood, and we got to go get organized. How do you organize it?
Somebody has to take the lead, and nobody has at this point.
Well, I'm kind of guiding and stuff like that. I know kind of where I think it's going to go.
But nobody's trying to lead the camp itself.
Yeah.
And arrange for everything to be set.
Yeah, there's no quote-unquote, you're the boss at this point. And so, one of the discussion has been between, do we do it on a religious-type basis? Or combine the two together or not? Well, the example is in Nauvoo. Was the church organization the same as the city organization?
No.
No. They were separate. Okay. And then you have the Council of 70. Where would the Council of 50 fit in? You ever hear about the Council of 50? Okay. And so, lots of fun little interesting things that we've already started learning about this. So come on in and read whatever post. You don't have to be part of the member of the families that are participating if you want to put some ideas, whatever, like this. But it gives us some ideas to say, and we're going to have some problems. I can guarantee it. We're going to say, we've made up a couple fictitious families to say, and one of them's going to be a real problem-causing family. I can tell you that now. Anyway. So let me tell you a little bit about who I am and why. Let me ask before you got, for those who've never been here before, why did you come? Why did you come? Well, I know the old people, you're nuts. So, that's simple. Okay, but, if you've never been here before, who persuaded you to come? Why?
Like,
what did they tell you?
I like your books.
What?
I like your books.
Yeah. Well, I know you anyway. Okay.
I'd like you to stop doing these. So, when I heard that you were doing one, I thought, I'll go check it out.
tell you a little bit about my background, of who I am and why I get up and do some of these lectures and stuff. In 1989, somebody in General Conference, somewhere around that time, basically said, just don't study the scriptures. You've got to, you know, just don't read the scriptures. You got to study them. So I was living in a little place called Gunnison, Utah. You blink once, you'd miss it as you go through. Now it's more because they got a prison there. Well, I left before. I escaped before the prison was there. And so we decided to pick a topic, and they said, pick a topic and study all the footnotes and all that kind of stuff. So we, my family and a couple other families, got together and said, well, let's do that. Let's start doing some family meetings together, and so we got some good friends. And so we picked the topic of the last days. Part of it was because there were a lot of rumors going around about activities or things, prophecies and visions or whatever on this line. Some felt right, but we didn't know. And some felt wrong, but we didn't know enough to say which one's right. So we decided to find out. And so we just started learning a whole bunch of stuff. Well, as we were doing this, and then he lost his job and moved away, so we kind of continued. What had happened was that as we're studying and putting things together, now, the way I kind of study the scriptures is that to do this was I'd been involved in computers, and I got hold of a PC at the time, and it helped, say, to write the scriptures out and then, you know, add other scriptures to it. Because they're saying, you know, for example, they're here, and they're here, and they're here, and they're here. They're in this book, they're in this book, they're in this book, they're in this book. And so we put it together. So literally, I was retyping the scriptures and I did it in outline form. And that helped a lot to understand the scriptures. Because if you've ever noticed, you could be going reading down the verse like this, and in the scriptures, he'll suddenly come to a word or a phrase, and then the Lord will go off on that word or phrase and spend maybe 10 verses or 2 pages or whatever explaining what that meant, and then he could come right back to where it was and go down. Well, I'm still lost out here. You know, I never come back. But if you outline it, you can see it visually. I'm a real visual guy. And so we started learning some of that stuff and saying, oh, it started to make a little sense. And so we said, well, what does this mean? And so after the scriptures, we went and researched what the prophets and apostles said about it. And as we were doing that, some things were happening in the newspaper. And when we'd be reading the scriptures and saying, we think this is what that means, and this is what it's talking about, and all of a sudden we're saying, wait a minute, that's the headlines of today's newspapers talking about that very thing. If we're saying what's right, then we're seeing it happen right now. And so we kind of took that attitude of saying, let's define what the scriptures, the events of the last days are. And then if we define that, we can then see, kind of make them in a list. Can we put them in a list? And as we tried to put them in a list of sequence, we found out there is, in my opinion, there is apparently a sequence of events. And we'll take down, how many brought your scriptures with you? Oh, you got it.
Came straight from work.
Yeah, okay. Well, you should write something to take notes with then. All right.
So go get them in the car?
Yeah, if they're in the car, go get them. Absolutely. Anyway, what we'll do is I'll show you what I think we found in the scripture, the sequence there. And as you go down through it, and then you apply it to things that have happened. And that's kind of somewhat fairly easy because, you know, a lot of things like the destruction of Jerusalem, documented, well known, you know, things along these lines. And if we are getting close to the Savior's return, then we should be, you know, seeing some of those signs there. Should be close to there. Now, nobody knows when the Savior's going to return. I really don't care. As I study the scriptures, there appears to be a whole series of events that happened maybe 20, 30, 50, 50 years before the Savior actually comes. If you're not prepared for those events and survive those, you won't be around to meet the Savior anyway, so who cares? Okay? And so half my purpose is to prepare people to say, well, let me tell you what what some things are just around the corner, it appears. And I'll kind of lay it out, and you make up your own mind. Now, I don't have any authority at all. I'm just a nobody guy, okay? And what happened was we did this little study at home, and then we kind of wrote it up, because that's going to help because I was doing that. Passed around a few friends, and pretty soon they said, this is good stuff. You know, put your references in there. Because it was always trouble to go through and say, I got to pull out the book here. That's it. I'm pulling out. So I started putting everything right there. So you can see all of it, all easy. And then it became really easy. They shared it with others. And pretty soon we had bookstores calling up and said, could you print this in a publish? And we couldn't staple it together. And then we spoured about it and did some other things along this line. Pretty soon, a book distributor called up and said, listen, we got bookstores wanting this. You know, if you put a cover and you actually put, you know, made it a binding, I don't have any money for binding. I was teaching school at the time, music, and so I finally did some stuff and finally had money. We hot glued in the first 300 books, you know, into the covers. We finally had my money and, you know, gave it to them and said, well, here, see if they sell. I said, great. And they were gone in about 3 or 4 weeks. And they said, oh, this is great. Well, by this time, we had some money, some miraculous things happened. We had money. And we printed up 1,000 of them. And they sold out in just a few weeks. And they said, we've got orders for about 3,000 or 4,000 more. I said, you haven't even paid us for the first stuff yet. And they actually helped us arrange for a loan to do that. Well, that was right Christmas time. The next year, 91, it was the number one selling book of all books for Desert Book for like 8 straight months. Number one book. And then it went up, it was like number 2, the number 3, it ended up being for the year number 4. The 3 books that knocked it out of first place was a little biography by a guy named Hinckley, another one by Faust, and some guy wrote a book, but, you know, his name was Gerald Lund. Okay. And mine was, you know, and the thing was, those were all, of course, general authorities and presidents of the church and things like that. And they're all saying, you sold 10,000 copies of your book just through Deseret Book. We've never had anything. Nobody knows who you are, but they all like your book. And it was terrible. Anybody here have one of those original copies? It was misspellings, you know, because it was just a little hand type thing. We actually went off to Office Max and, you know, printed them off. That's how the pages were. That's why it's the book. Anyway, it's still the number one selling book on the Events of the Last Days. In fact, they're telling me we've pretty well got sold out again. I've written 5 other books about it because people kept asking more questions and more details. And so as we went along, each one in turn became another best-selling book in the LDS market. Now, we're going to talk about some other things. One of the interesting things is that people start asking to do firesides and lectures, you know, like this. And so we kind of said, okay, start doing that. After the lectures, as we talked about these events, people would come up and say, I don't know why, but I would like to share with you a dream or a vision that I've had about some events that you've just talked about. Okay. Guy, I like to listen to things and learn. So we sit there, and I remember once we went down to, we started having big enough crowds here in Dixie College, in the high school auditorium place. And we'd be outside, we'd have about 400 or 500 people at Dixie College, and then we'd quit about 11 or 12 o'clock, and then we'd go outside. And I remember once we stood outside, and there were 20 people standing right there in a circle, all wanting to share the dreams and visions. And we said, okay, we'll just stand in a circle, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and just go down. And what was interesting, and really brought it out, was they all said the same thing. You know, 20 people had never met before, and as they related their dreams and visions, they were all had seen basically the same kind of stuff. That was kind of getting spooky. And I started categorizing them into 3 groups, Category A, Category B, and Category C, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. And so then I started to say, you know, and it started happening again and again. I must have had 700 dreams recounted to me. I went and then said, you know, this is really interesting because people, even non-LDS, were saying the same stuff. not seeing the same things. So I went to Klinos Galzin. He'd become a friend, and I said, what does this mean that people are telling me these dreams? He says, this is important. Write it down. Have them write it down and send it to you. So I did. And we got the bishop and we changed their names and some of the locations so they can know exactly where they were, like the bishop of the northern area, northern Utah, and other things like that. So we changed their names and stuff, and we posted it on my website. And it's been fun. It's been interesting reading some of it. We've had some very, very interesting things. Fill this in with blanks. So let me go through the scriptures real quickly and show you some of the real basic stuff. So why don't you turn to Luke chapter 21. We'll start there. That's the easiest on that. Alright. Luke chapter 21. Well, let me set the stage here. The Savior, this is about a week before the Savior dies. Before the Savior is put on the hill. And he's in the temple, and he is ripping on the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the lawyers there. And he's just letting it all, you know, if you really read it, he's not nice, calling them murderers and liars and hypocrites, white sepulchers full of bones. Boy, that wasn't much worse than that for a Jew, etc. And he's just letting them know exactly the, you know. Now, what's interesting is that they are all asking him, if you are the Son of God. They knew what he was saying. Okay? If you are the Son of God, then give us a sign. So he gives them two signs. The first sign he says, destroy this and the temple. And one first sign is this temple will be destroyed. There won't be one stone left upon another. He's standing in the courtyard of the temple. And they said, yeah, right, sure. Okay. Give us another sign. And then he said, I think what he meant, what he pointed, he says, destroy this temple, meaning himself. He says, my father will raise it up in 3 days. And they thought he was still talking about the big temple. Okay, so he's there. They don't get it. But he's given them the two signs to watch for. And so he walks out. Now, his disciples, who've been listening to this, gather right outside the gate of the temple. And question him and say, okay, we understand a little bit about the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. And he says, you really don't. So he talks to them a minute there to ask them a couple questions. He tells them a couple things there. Then he leaves, and goes up to the Mount of Olives. You know that beautiful picture by, what's his name, Olson? Is it? Greg Olson. For the Savior over in Jerusalem, that's about the time. He's sitting there, and according to Mark, Peter, James, John, and Andrew then follow him up there and sit and talk to him. Okay, now that conversation that follows is recorded in four places. It's recorded in Luke chapter 21, Mark chapter 13, Matthew, the famous Matthew chapter 24. Okay? And it's so important that the Savior gave it again to Joseph Smith, and it comprises most of section Doctrine and Covenants 45. Paul and Peter, and even James, later on, as they write, all quote from Matthew 24 off and on. Okay? From that lecture. Alright? So, what was the question? The question they ask is the same question that everybody always asks at the time of Adam. They learn enough about the gospel, learn about the second coming of Jesus Christ, okay, when the millennium starts, everybody wants to be there. And Adam asked, is it going to be in our day? No. Abraham, is it going to be in our day? No. Enoch, is it going to be in my day? No. It's always the question, is it going to be us? Is it our turn? And Isaiah says, wish it were mine. Jeremiah, wish it was me. They all see Ezekiel, same thing, wish it was mine. Nephi, go to all the books, same kind of thing. Nephi and Lehi, wish it was us. Alma, we're all, finish up Alma and the Gila. Wish it was us. Here's Nephi says, oh, I wish it was, you know. And so they all ask the same question. Is it us? Okay? And so they ask it in a nice way, and they say, give us the signs of the destruction of, we understand the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Tell us when that's going to happen, and the end of the world, or the destruction of the wicked, which is the end of the world. Okay? So turn to section 21 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Luke chapter 21. Sections 21, Mark 13, 24, all together, because each one has specific parts. For example, we learn only from Mark who actually went up the mount. The actual question they asked, the most detailed, is in Matthew 24. But you get the same kind of drift in all of these. So here it is. We'll start in Luke 21 and verse 6. As for these things which ye behold, the day will come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And they asked him, saying, Master, when shall these things be? And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? This is Matthew, this is Peter, James, John, and Andrew up on the hill. And so he says, okay, I'm going to answer your question. And he does. And he said, take heed that ye be not deceived. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and the time draweth near. Go ye not therefore after them. But when ye hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. Then he said unto them, you've heard this one, nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines and pestilences and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven. Now, verse 12 is an important verse. It's a key one. Because it starts off with that age-old nemesis of the English language, but. Okay? But, before all these. Alright, so here you have these set of events. Nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. You know, great signs in heaven, pestilence, famines, and earthquakes. But before these things happen, something else is going to happen. So you have to take that aside, put it here, and he's going to tell you actually what happens before that. All right? And then later on he comes back and picks that up. All right. So he says, but before all these, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Let's drop to verse 16. And you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolks and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. Okay? Some of you. There's four of them up there. Who does it? Doesn't disqualify.
John makes it through.
Yeah, John makes it through. Okay? Some of you, three of you, to be exact, you should be hated of all men for my name's sake. Okay? Verse 20. When ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Now, then Peter, James, and John, and going, being good Jews, they knew what he was talking about. The desolation of abomination. In fact, he used the full word in Matthew 24. The desolation of abomination had happened during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had surrounded, you know, Jerusalem, had brought it down. This is the time of Zedekiah. This is when Lehi left, around 600 AD. Okay. BC, thank you. They laid siege to Jerusalem. And then when they finally broke down the walls of Jerusalem, the Jews who were surviving then went into the temple. They laid siege to the walls of the temple, broke the walls of the temple down, and massacred everybody inside. Okay? Now, what's interesting is that most of the people who had beforehand, Nebuchadnezzar had said, I'm going to take you guys, and I'm going to take you prisoners. Ezekiel said, don't fight him, pay him tribute. No, Jeremiah said, don't fight him, pay him tribute, and if he asks you to go, then go. Peaceably. And that's where Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and a lot of people, then are carried away before that happens, off to Babylon. Everybody who remained, who listened to the false prophets, got wiped out. So there would have been abomination of desolation. Jerusalem surrounded by armies again, know that the desolation is going to happen a second time. So what do you do? Well, the reason for prophecy is so you know what to prepare for. That's the whole reason. Okay? It's not to befuddle people. It's not to confuse people. It's to help those who have faith to listen so they can prepare for what's coming. So here he tells them, gives them instructions. When you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, encompassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. And let them which are in the midst of Judea depart out. And let not them that are in the countries, you know, the outside countries, come in. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are of a child, and to them that give suck in those days. For there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. Now, there's a hard doctrine right there. A lot of people say, well, he will be merciful to the, you know, the poor and the sick and the elderly and the pregnant, stuff like that. Wouldn't he? Wouldn't he? What has he said? Sorry. Whoa. Sorry about that. They will probably all die. Okay? And most people, you know, a lot of people, and it's a false concept that's taught a lot, especially lately, last few, you know, 4 or 5 years, that if you're righteous, all you have to be is good. And you don't have to do any preparation, and you'll be fine. You'll be safe. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, when you die, you're supposed to be much
okay. Now, did the Lord put us all here to commit suicide?
But the point is, yeah, you know, if you don't want to survive in this life, yeah, go prepare. And if you're a good person every other way, you probably get a chance to go to
the That's right. Okay. And so he says, you know, there'll be tough times here. And so it's going to hurt. Verse 24 is a very key verse. For they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Paul talks about that again in Romans, in chapter 11, verse 25. Okay, so he says, first of all, Jerusalem's going to be wiped out, surrounded, wiped out, and those who survive are going to be carried away a second time. So the abomination of desolation, the same thing that happened during 600 B.C., is going to happen a second time. It's going to be Jerusalem's going to be surrounded. Those who survive are going to be carried away. Those who don't are going to be slaughtered. Okay, big time. All right? He says, now, the Gentiles, Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Okay, what does that mean? What does that mean? Who are the Gentiles? The non-Jews. So Jerusalem is going to be run over and controlled by the non-Jews for a period of time. Okay? How long? Did he say? No. He just says until the time of the Gentiles is over or fulfilled. When the time of the Gentiles is over, then they will relinquish control, and the Jews will then gain control of the Jerusalem. All right. Now, we've identified a few events. First of all, when did Jerusalem get destroyed a second time? When did the abomination of desolation happen a second time? 70 AD. Romans, under Titus. Okay? Happened just exactly right. Okay? Was there anything left of the temple? Not one stone left upon another. Josephus describes it. You couldn't even tell there was a city there. Now, this is interesting. Now, this is important. Josephus, who was a witness to the destruction, said there was not one single stone of the city. Not only the temple mount was destroyed, the temple itself, the foundation, everything, and including all the stones of the foundations of every building in the city, were rooted up by the Romans, and others carted them off for other cities. You couldn't even tell that there had been a city there. Okay? So what are they talking about now? You ever heard of a place called the Temple Mount? Now, here you say Josephus says it was completely destroyed. The only place that was not destroyed were they housed the Roman 10th Legion. throughout, gripping the whole place, looking for gold. As they set things on fire, the Jews have a habit of digging holes and hiding it in the foundation and the cracks and stuff like that. And when they set fire to buildings like that, the gold melted and cracked down. So they literally tore everything up looking for the good old yellow stuff. Okay? And so there was, you couldn't even tell where the Temple Mount was. So if the Temple Mount was completely destroyed, what are they fighting over right now? Come on, put two and two together. This is advanced gospel doctrine.
Location.
They're fighting over the fort of Antonius. The Temple Mount is actually 300 yards to the south of where they're fighting over. The Dome of the Rock is not on the Temple Mount. Right? Right? And the other thing, there's another big clue as well. On the Temple Mount, there was a spring. Okay? That's what they used to fill the baptismal font. The lather, what they call it, that lever or whatever, out front. They did all that and washed down. Is there a spring on the place where they're fighting over now? No, there is not. Another clue is that that place was the original Temple Mount was a crushing place. Flat. No rock. What's unique about the Temple Mount they're fighting over? It's a big rock there. That's where, you know, Abraham was supposed to have sacrificed Isaac, could have been, okay? Or that's where Muhammad touched it, and whatever, you know, that kind of stuff, all right? So they're fighting in the wrong place. What's actually happening is that the Wailing Wall, the most holy wall, is actually the south part of the Fort Antonius. In fact, if you get back into your old history, if you look, do some research on this, there's a good book on, written on this, they're actually the corner where the Wailing Wall is where they used to have the old temple to Jupiter used to be. So it's interesting that the Jews are worshiping the temple of Jupiter. Well, inside, they've missed it again. You know, isn't it ironic? They've missed it again. Anyway, just a little trivia. Now you know. Next time you go to BYU education class, you can raise your hand and cause all sorts of problems.
The R, the capital R, with the little X, see on all the drugstores.
Uh-huh.
That's also in the name of Jupiter.
Yeah.
When,
yes.
When you take drugs, it's in the name of Jupiter.
Yeah. Yes. You know, all the time I actually believe that the Wailing Wall was after part of the foundation of the old Temple Mount. Now you're saying that there's nothing recognizable of the real Temple Mount these days.
According to Josephus. In fact, the research was done a couple of years ago. You do an internet search. It's called, what is it? Somebody help me. Got an article. I wrote an article about this. But there was a book out by a historian about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And he did all the research about why did they start calling it. And it actually started calling what they call the Fort of Antonius the Temple Mount by the Caliph. They call it a holy site. He didn't want it to tear down. And it happened about 1200 AD is when it started being called the Holy Site. And tradition had it, etc. along this line. It's the same kind of reasoning. You know, where was the Mount Sinai? Where's Mount Sinai?
Someone said it's over in actually Arabia.
In Saudi Arabia.
Right.
The key is interesting is that if you go all throughout the, you know, the Israel land, you know, that part of the west of the Red Sea, okay, there is not a single mountain that fits any of the description of the Mount Sinai. Not one. Not one at all. Okay? But there are a couple that come close, and one that fits exactly over in Saudi Arabia. Interestingly enough, and this is a dead giveaway, is that it's in the land of Midian. Do you know where the land of Midian is?
Yes.
Saudi Arabia. Okay. You figure somebody would have put that, you know, two and two together. What's more interesting is that if you find out the history, why do they have a mountain where they call it Mount Sinai? Well, it happened, so happened that. It was the mother of, who's the guy, Greek guy who conquered everything? Alexander the Great. She had a dream or vision that if she went down and worked.
worship and put a monument of some kind or a temple on Mount Sinai, that her son would be, be unconquerable, but never die. And so she comes down and can't find the mountain, determines this is it, puts a little temple there, and that becomes designated, and that's where all the tourists go down. Okay? Alright, fun little trivia stuff.
Okay,
so how many hundred feet away from this?
About 300 feet to the south.
The south.
Uh-huh. 300 feet to the south.
What is there now?
Somebody said it was a junkyard, a car lot. But I don't know. I've asked somebody who's actually been there, but nobody can remember. And so.
Ask Glenn Kemp.
Okay. Next time I see Glenn. I haven't seen him in a long time. All right. Anyway, go back to here. Go back to, the video can carry away a trivia. Fun stuff. Do the homework. Beware of those who claim to be experts, so don't listen to me. I never claim. All right. So the Jerusalem will be trodden down for a period of time until the time of the Gentiles can be over. So when do the Gentiles' time get over? When do the Jews come back and control Jerusalem?
Afterwards.
1967. With the Six-Day War. Okay. All right. They started coming back after Orson High came. They started coming back, and Joseph Dillon Smith wrote a lot about that. After it was designated, they started coming back. Then in 1947, they had the war where they controlled Israel, and actually became a state. But they didn't control Jerusalem until 67. Now, it's important because he said basically then, that is the big sign that says the time of the Gentiles is over. Okay. Now this is important, and we'll get to it a little bit later. Add a few more things on why that is important. But he says that after the time of the Gentiles, things are going to happen. So what does he say is going to happen? There shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations, with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Remember those other verses about nations against nations and famines and pestilences? Those verses we took out, this is where you put them back in. Men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then is a sequence word. Okay, and then, so after you see those things, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with power and great glory. What is that? Who told us what that was? Joseph Smith did. Joseph Smith said that great sign of the Son of Man. It will be classed by most of the world as a big planet, maybe a comet coming to hit the earth. But what is it really? It's Jesus and the city of Enoch and the host of heaven coming. Okay? But the world will say it's a big planet coming to hit the earth.
Did Joseph Smith said that?
Joseph Smith said, yeah. It's teachings from Prophet Joseph Smith. Okay?
What page is that?
Who's got my book? That's why I wrote the book, because it has all the references there. I didn't bring one of my own books.
What is the title of your book?
As a Thief in the Night.
As a Thief in the Night.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it has all the references for all this kind of stuff, exact quotes and things like that. So.
And you use books, what, $54?
They're going on, the used books are now going on eBay, and which is ridiculous. So, now here's what he says. So, here's his instruction. So, when you see these things, when you see that big sign, these things begin to come to pass, and look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. Okay? So, when you start seeing these things, know that what? It's close. It's really close. Okay? Be happy. Okay? Yes, we're going to have some hard times, but be happy. It's almost over. And he spake to them a parable, behold the fig tree. And all the trees. And when they now shoot forth, ye see no of your own selves that summer is now nigh at hand. So likewise ye, when ye shall see these things come to pass, know ye that the kingdom of God is nigh at hand. Verily I say unto you, this generation, the generation that starts seeing these signs, shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. And then he gives commandment, verse 36. Watch ye therefore, and pray always, that ye may be accounted worthy
to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Now, if you go over to Matthew 24, you find even more detail than that. But that's the rough to the easy one. Now, let me give you a clue on the Matthew 24. Of all the scriptures in the New Testament, Joseph Smith only rewrote one chapter. He added words in all over the place, but he only rewrote one chapter. Which chapter was that? Matthew 24. If you compare what Matthew 24, what he did, with what's in this, you know, the King James Version, all he didn't add much anything. All he did was rearrange the sequence so it matched as now Matthew 21 and it matches Mark 13. Okay? So, if we had a few more hours, we'd go through Matthew 24 because a few more details. Actually, in Matthew 24, the Savior said there'll be a third. In fact, he said, after you see all these signs, in fact, there'll be a third abomination of desolation. Okay? Where Jerusalem will be surrounded a third time. Okay? Now, these events are so important that every prophet is just about talked about. Daniel talked about it. He had the big, Nebuchadnezzar had the vision of the big statue, remember? And Daniel came up and interpreted it. You know, and we can go through each one of those kingdoms, down through the Greeks and then the Romans, etc., on this line of kingdoms. He said, in the time of the king, ten toes, on the time of the king, ten kingdoms. Now, Spencer W. Kimball in General Conference said the ten toes were the ten founding kingdoms of Europe. By the way, when was the last of those three kingdoms formed? Anybody know? Around 1830. Isn't that an interesting time? 1830 was the last of those 10 European founding kingdoms was established as an individual kingdom. Okay? The one who probably saw the most was John the Beloved, or John the Revelator. Okay? He wrote a book called Revelation. Now, his revelation, what's going on out there? They're not hosing somebody's car. I hear there's a whole lot of vandalism out there, so. All right, last night. Just be glad you're not in Paris. All right. Yeah, she's over here. Okay. John sees a series of a vision where he sees the periods of the world. Yeah, 1,000 years. So here's period 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Okay? And what's interesting is that as he sees this vision open up, he sees the main events of these periods and describes it. Now, what's interesting is the first 4,000 periods of time, this is Revelations 1, Revelations, he describes 4,000 years in 11 verses. Not a lot of detail. Okay? And he talks about this is a kingdom, this is a period of time when there's going to be war. Okay? And he describes as a person on a horse with a white horse conquering, being conquered. Interestingly enough, the next period of time, I think it's a red horse, isn't it? He talks about a red horse and then there's great wickedness, great evil there. Okay? The next, he describes all 1,000 years in about a verse and a half. This one describes a verse and a half. Now I'm going really fast so we get to the good stuff. Okay? This one, he talks about a pale horse. Okay? And famine. This is the time of who? Abraham. Abraham starts it off. Okay? But it's also in him, and you were right. Who else said? It was Joseph in Egypt. Now, if you, interestingly enough, what is the primary thing? This is the pale horse. And they have the scales. Okay, pale horse with the scales. Now,
And so what's the defining natural catastrophe that happens during most of Abraham's life? What is it?
Famine.
How long?
Years.
Multiple years. All right? He has a son named Isaac. If you read in the scriptures, during the lifetime of Isaac, there was a multi-year famine again. Okay? He has a son who is who?
Jacob.
All right? He has a son who's more famous than him, whose name was
Joseph
in Egypt. And what's the defining thing that happens in the time of Joseph in Egypt that saves Jacob?
Yeah.
7 years of famine.
Yeah.
All right. That's just the first part of it.
Okay.
You got three generations. What do you have? You got over 25 years of famine in three generations. Okay. Well, what they describe it as a pale horse where, life is held in the balance. Not very much. A penny for, penny a week, etc. People's lives are not there. Now, what's interesting is that we can get into some of the fun stuff. How many were listening to President Hinckley, last Saturday night conference, priesthood? Guess what he mentioned again? He mentioned the 7 years of famine, the historian Joseph. Do you know how many years ago he mentioned it again in priesthood?
7 years ago.
Very interesting. Okay. All right. The next, so the closer he gets, and I'm going really fast. I could spend about an hour and a half just on this stuff alone, but we want to get to more fun stuff. He goes through, this is the time of the Romans and coming into, the Savior comes in here. All right. Here's the Savior. And I have all these charts and graphs in the book and stuff like that. The Savior comes and born, all right. Destruction of Jerusalem is 70 AD. All that kind of stuff. This is when the Greeks come, the Nebuchadnezzar comes. I mean, all that kind of stuff happens throughout there. This whole area is conquered again and again and again and again and again. All right. As he gets closer and closer and closer to this time right here, he gets more details. Okay? He starts here about a verse and a half, a couple of verses, three or four verses. Then he starts getting about four or five verses. Then he gets down, as he gets close to here, he describes the major event in the sixth seal, in 6,000 years. All right? And as he describes it, he says there's some major importance. In fact, if you read it, he says, the Savior comes. He says there's some tremendous earthquake. That's one of the key things. There's a tremendous earthquake. There's everything. And the Savior comes. And then he starts describing events at the beginning of the seventh seal. And he describes almost during the seventh seal the same events with a few more things added in. So how can, and this confused people for a long time. So they said, how can the Savior come? Does he come twice? Once in the sixth seal, once in the seventh seal? Okay. It appears that there is a period of time right between the sixth seal and the seventh seal that of about 50 to 100 years that is so close and there's so many things happening right there, it's like the overlap. Can't really say today's the sixth, the sixth seal, and tomorrow morning we start the seventh seal. It's very difficult because there's so many things happening all at the same time. All right. So that's but there is one clue. There is one and only one big clue that tells us when the seventh seal is opened. All right. And that's the Doctrine and Covenants, section 77, verse 13. Background on this. Joseph's sitting there with some elders, and the Lord basically said, ask questions and I'll answer, like if Joseph answers. And they hear the answers too, by the way. And so Joseph, so what do you think they ask questions about? The last days. How close are we? Just like everybody else wants to know. So don't feel bad if you want to know. Okay?
Everybody always has.
And so one of the questions they ask is, who's got section 77, verse 13? Okay, who's got that? Read the question.
Question, what are the things to be accomplished which are written in the ninth chapter of Revelation? Answer, they are to be accomplished after the opening of the seventh seal, before the coming of Christ.
Okay, now, you know, must have read that a gazillion times, but I always been taught growing up that the seventh seal starts when the Savior comes, right? Is that what the scripture said?
No.
No. He said there's something that happens that's described in Revelation chapter 9 that happens after the seventh seal is opened, but before the Savior comes. Oh, okay. So, what is that stuff written in chapter 9? Well, let me tell you. Chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9 describe what we call the seven last plagues of the wrath of God. Now, John describes them in two groups. He kind of breaks them down into two groups. Now what we're going to do is basically looks like this. Okay? John sees the overview, like any good lecture would be. He gives you the overview, and then he's going to tell you all the stuff that fits in this little period of time, about the width of that line. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about, with some of the stuff right through here. Okay? The first four are of events that are significant enough that you can say they're happening, but he gives no time frames. He gives just just enough clue to say, if you see things like this happening, it's getting really close. And there's four of them, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay. One of them is that the waters would become polluted throughout, the fresh waters of the earth would become polluted. One would be that the seas and waters would become polluted. One would be that the, what is it? The trees and stuff are burned. And he doesn't say how long it takes. He says, you'll see these things going on.
Fish will die in the ocean.
Yeah, the fish, fish and things will die in the ocean. A lot of strange things going on. Okay? But, and you can go through that. He describes one. He gives one name to one thing. He describes an event that says it's like something's come down from earth, and all of a sudden he says it's like the sun. It's a star, meteorite going, and things glowing, and it contaminates the water and pollution. And he says, and he gives it a name. It's the only thing he gives a name, and he says, and he describes it as wormwood. And he describes wormwood two things. He says, it's wormwood. It makes the waters bitter. People drink the waters and die. And it's in a place called wormwood. And it's my opinion that what he describes is what we call Chernobyl, which is still the greatest nuclear accident the world has ever known, and we're still being affected by it today. It's still happening, by the way. All they did was pour cement over it. It is still releasing a tremendous amount of radiation into the groundwater, and every year it keeps spreading a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further. In fact, they made a movie about it, about the contamination going on along this line. And what was the name of the movie?
Godzilla.
Godzilla. Yeah, that's where he was. He was at Chernobyl, getting the radioactive worms from leftover Chernobyl. That's still happening, by the way. Still going on. That radiation has contaminated the water throughout the entire world. They didn't think it was bad. Every year they did a new study, and they found it to be worse and worse and worse. And they've actually found a radioisotope from Chernobyl, the signature, in ice in the Arctic, in Italy, America, etc., everywhere. Now, what's interesting is small parts of radioactive poisoning never comes out and say, oh, boy, right, that's radioactive poisoning. Okay, what happens is it comes as leukemia and other diseases. And so what's interesting is we've seen an increase of that kind of disease. Okay, all sorts of things. We'll put that to the side for right now. Let's talk about 5, 6, and 7.
Question, I heard that the translation for Chernobyl was wormwood.
Exactly, it is.
Okay. Russian, it means
wormwood. Yeah, and they put it there because in the place it's lousy with the stuff. Okay. And it's very bitter. And Peggy, you can tell you a little bit about it. During the early 1900s, late 1800s, the Europeans had a really drink, and it was made out of wormwood, which is Ukrainian for Chernobyl, means wormwood. It was a very bitter drink, but they found out, and it was a very popular drink for a short period of time, but they found out the more you drank it, then you eventually go crazy, after a few years go crazy, and then die. So like I said, it was a very short, but very popular drink for a period of time. but very, very bitter. Okay. There's a lot to be said that. There's a type in the shadow there somewhere. Anyway, so let's talk about the 5th, 6th, and 7th plague because those are the real key ones. All right, we could argue a little bit back and forth about plague number 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. But as John describes plague number 5, 6, and 7, okay, he describes a couple things. First of all, let's describe plague number 7. Plague number 7 is the Savior coming to the world, destroying all the wicked in a big ball of fire. Alright. That's an easy one. When that happens, trust me, you'll know about it. Alright. So that's the second coming to the world. There's three major events, plague number 5, plague number 2, and plague number 6, and those are three wars. Three wars, one after another. Okay? The three wars are very strange. The first one is a very strange war. This is described in Revelation chapter 9, the first half of Revelation chapter 9. It is described as the fifth plague, the first of the three woes. Why is chapter 9 important? Doctrine and Covenants, section 77, verse 9, verse 13. He asked, what about the events in chapter 9? Alright? Chapter 9 contains these two events. A 5-month war, and a 13-month war. And for the first time now, John gives us details. So, if we could identify those events and then look at history and see if they've happened or are about to happen, then we can get an idea how close we really are. So let's talk about some of those events that fifth war, the fifth plague talks about. Right? John, for the first time, says, and I call it a really silly or strange war. It's so strange that it's like John is saying, when you see this is so strange, you'll be able, here we are, a period of time of wars and rumors of wars, but this war is so different, so strange, you should be easily, it's like in waving flags. You see this war, you'll know it's this one. Alright? He gives them seven identifying things. First one, it's 5 months long. In this war, the adversary, the bad group army, has power to hurt people for 5 months and then loses power. Okay. So, let's think of 100 years. How many wars would fit that criteria right there? How about World War I? World War II? How about Korea? How about Vietnam? Okay, what's left after that? Desert Storm. How about Desert Storm 1? Well, as a matter of fact, from the day Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait until we started bombing him when he started losing power, it was pretty close to about 5 months, within a couple of days. That's interesting. All right. Well, that's one. How many other events? Well, he said this war... Yeah, there's always smoke and stuff like that. tremendous amount of smoke. It's like it comes right out of the ground, like hell's opened up, and it comes right out of the ground and darkens the moon, the sun, and the stars. Did we have that during Desert Storm?
It torched all the wells.
Okay. Well, now we're two for two. Okay. Another thing he describes there, he says there are two armies. There's usually at least two armies in a war. Okay. But he says in this, these two armies, one is a good army, and we know that because they're sealed in their foreheads. Now, what does that mean? Well, there's a spiritual sealing, and then there's a physical sealing. Well, it's interestingly enough, if you go back to Haifan Shaman, you go back to Ezekiel, during the time of Jerusalem, during the first abomination of desolation, you get, I think it's around chapter 10 or 16, somewhere around there in Ezekiel, the Lord has four angels come before him. And the first angel he talks to has an inkhorn. And he says to the angel, he says, I want you to go through the city of Jerusalem and seal in the forehead, mark in the forehead, those who still bow the knee and confess the sin of Israel. In other words, the righteous. He sends them off. Then he says, the next three, he says, the rest of you go out through the whole city and kill every man, woman, and child, everything who doesn't have the fourth seal on the forehead. Destroy everybody else. Spare not the womb, spare not anything. Okay? So, in this battle, there is one army that is sealed or protected from harm. Shouldn't be a lot of death in it. Alright, so we had two armies. Okay? Do we have one army with very little death and one army with a lot of death in it? Strangely, yeah. Okay? And now, how do you tell good armies from bad armies? How do you tell good from evil?
Actions.
What they're fighting for.
The
purpose.
Yeah, their motive.
Their motive, okay? That's what Moroni always says. He says, if they would leave us alone, we'd be fine. But we're fighting for our families and our homes and our religion and the freedom. What were the Lamanites always fighting for? Power, or the Gadian for power. We want to control. We want to make you our slaves. It's what you're fighting for. Okay? And so, so we have one army. So we have that. So we're three for three. Interestingly enough, another thing that happens is that, in fact, it was actually safer to be in the Desert Storm 1 than it was to be on the streets of New York City. There were more deaths per 1,000 population in New York than there was for our troops in Desert Storm. Someone got a thought? Yes?
So are you saying that in Desert Storm 1 we were over there fighting for our freedom and our families?
We were fighting for the Kuwaitis.
Who used to be a part of Iraq.
Well, I don't want to get into the politics, but it appears that they, were we fighting for oil? We weren't there. Did we follow them in and take over Iraq at that time?
Well, I think our Secretary of State told me we didn't care what they did.
No, they stopped them, actually. Okay. They were, Saddam Hussein was in raping and pillaging and looting Kuwait. We came and stopped them. Okay. In that battle, were our troops out raping and pillaging? No, they weren't. They were there stopping that. If you've ever read the actual accounts, now there's some guy, some sergeant or whatever from the Marines who said, yeah, we raped and pillaged the roof. Now they found out after 3 or 4 days of big media blitz, he was a liar. Never did it. And he admits it now. He says, well, I was paid to say that. Okay. Well, only the retraction is now on page 47, not on the front page news.
Well, did he say he was paid?
Yeah, they paid him.
Who paid
him
to say it?
He hasn't said that yet.
Oh,
yeah, that will be very interesting. Yes.
Well, didn't Saddam rape Kuwaiti oil wells?
Oh, he did that. The other ones that set them on fire.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, another thing he said in this war, a very strange thing he said, there will be no trees, no grass, nor any green thing hurt in this war. Did that take place in Kuwait? Right.
Why would he even mention that? That's just
because it's so strange. Would that apply to Vietnam? Now remember, we were in a time of wars and rumors of war. Would that apply to World War II, World War I, Korea, Vietnam, any of those? is in the middle of nowhere, and that's exactly where that, no trees, no grass, nor any green thing got hurt. Isn't that strange? Strange enough you'd be able to say, yeah. All right, that's number four, where are we up to, four or five. Another thing, he describes tanks and helicopters. He does a really good job for a guy, and, you know, in around 70 AD, 80 AD, describing helicopters. He describes them as locusts, but they look like locusts. Now, have you ever seen a locust flying that has its wings out and, you know, like this? He says, but they're like armored, horses armored for battle. So how do you armor a horse for battle? Put layers of armor on it, okay? He says, and here's the key one, he says, and their wings are like the sound of horses and chariots running to battle. What a bunch of horses. You ever been around a bunch of horses running? What does it sound like? The earth shakes, the whole thing. Like, ever hear a bunch of Apache helicopters flying overhead? What happens? Same kind of effect. The earth shakes and the whole thing along this line. Great description. Great description. And shoot fire and brimstone. Okay, out of their tails. You know, tanks. So it does a great job of that. All right. That's four number five. Is the five-month war. Now, I don't have any authority. But he goes, it's seven for seven things. John describes the first half of chapter 9 fits Desert Storm to a T. Not two out of five, seven. Not three out of seven, seven for seven. Even the two strange ones, the three strange ones. Two armies, one not hurt very much, very little death. There's no trees, no grass, and a great amount of smoke. Okay? Interesting. Now, if that's the case, then according to Doctrine and Covenants, section 77, verse 13, are we in the seventh seal now? The answer is yeah. Okay? So according to the scriptures we read, things should start happening faster. We should see an acceleration of wickedness. We should see an acceleration of earthquakes, volcanoes, plagues, seas, overheating its bounds. Are we seeing an increase in those kind of activities? Yeah. Okay. So it all kind of fits. Okay. In fact, you can go back to about 1967 in one of the books, and I actually did that. All right. The second half of Revelation chapter 9 is even worse. He starts off saying this is the second woe, and it's the sixth plague. He describes two wars. The first war is a real doozy. It's a war that lasts 1 year, 1 month, 1 day, and interestingly, 1 hour. Only in really modern times can you get down to the hour. I call it, for reference sake, the 13-month war. This is actually 13 months, a day, and an hour. Okay? In this war, again, modern weapons. He describes modern weapons. It lasts that long. The army involved is 200 million. That's a significant number. We'll tell you about that. But even a more important or more significant number is it kills one-third of all the people on the earth. Now, there's approximately 6 billion people on the earth right now. That'd be about 2 billion people. Now, interestingly enough, if you have all of the wars for the last 1,000 years, and all the casualties of people who died from these wars, if you add it up all together, every single war, I mean from the Crimean to the even to the Crusades, which we seem to be a big topic nowadays, you know, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, all those wars, put all the people dead together, okay, it wouldn't even come to be 1 billion. So, you know, in 1,000 years, all the wars haven't killed 1 billion people. So how do you kill 2 billion people in just 13 months? What kind of weapons would you have to use? Nuclear, biological, chemical.
All of the above.
All of the above. Okay. I don't think it would kill that many, but, you know, who knows? They're coming with some really fun ones. Okay? The big one would be, you know, biologicals and stuff along the atomic nuclear. Now, all right. That's one thing. Let's go with it another way. Is there Is there an army of 200 million anywhere?
China.
Well, what country would could be able to field an army of 200 million? China. Who's the largest army in the world? China. Who's the second largest army? No, Russia.
Russia.
Russia is. Okay? Russia is. You have to understand, we could take about 25 minutes on Russia and its fake death. It's funny that they said, all of a sudden, here's Khrushchev saying, we're going to hate you, we're going to kill you, your children are going to be our slaves, etc., like this, we'll do anything, you know, hardline communists, etc. And all of a sudden, the communists in Russia said, peace, we found it, happiness. We forgive you, we're broke, give us all your money, disband your armies, you know, we're not going to attack you anymore, so disband your armies. Well, what they did, they said, see, we're going to disband our armies, we're going to let all of our soldiers go. We only have enough money to feed our, and keep and train our officers. What's wrong with that?
Why have officers if you don't have an officer?
You're broke, aren't you?
Well, here's the thing. Well, how do we get soldiers for our armies in time of war? We draft them, okay? How do the Russians and the Chinese, the communists, get their soldiers in time of the war? Conscripts. Basically, the officer who's been trained, he walks down the street and says, you, you're now submarine. You're now my outfit, get over here, here's your rifle, let's go. Full authority to shoot them in the back if they don't obey his instructions. Okay? The Russians only, standard operating procedure, they only train the officers, ever. During times of peace, they always let the conscripts go, because where did they get them? Just off the streets. So when they said, well, we don't have money to heal, all we have enough money is for our nuclear weapons, our new submarines, our new airplanes, and we're going to let all the little soldiers go, that's just standard procedure. But they pounded off on us saying, we're going to let our arms go, so you let yours go. There was an interesting book called, by a guy named Anatoly Golitsyn, called New Lies for Old. He was actually at one point a colonel in the KGB, and one of the things that he came over in the late 60s, 68, 69, said is that he worked on a project, and that project he was the destruction of America. He says they had come to the conclusion under Khrushchev that they couldn't beat the United States anymore. They always had more people. We always had better stuff. You know, they would have 20. We'd have one plane. They would have 20 planes. But our one plane, because our technology, could shoot down the 20. They could never beat us. And so he says, what we're going to have to do is follow Sun Yat-sen, was it?
Sun Tzu.
Exactly, yeah. And he says, fake it. Fake, we're dead. Actually, Lenin had done that in 1930s. Okay? And so and he said, let's do it on a big scale. And so they said, we're going to pretend, we're going to set everything up, we're going to pretend like communism is over, we're going to embrace democracy, we're going to try to get as much money as we can to come in to rebuild our infrastructure, we're going to see if we can persuade them to disband NATO, and to disarm the United States, because there's no need, and then we'll be quick to rearm and attack when they're at their lowest.
Dump down our children and get rid of problems.
Huh?
Dump down our children and get rid
well,
of
problems. Well, that was, yeah, they had help on the inside. Anyway, and so they had enough agents, they believe, in the United States to get that done. They control the media throughout the world. And so they said it's going to take us 30 to 50 years to work this plan out and get it done. So we're going to think, they even said, now he came out with a book, and this was in late 70s, a book, and he's in this book he said, there, part of that plan is they're going to tear down the Berlin Wall. When he wrote that in the book, guess what everybody in the world said?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. And so it was conveniently forgotten when they, you know, 12 years later, they tore down the Berlin Wall and declared communism dead. Well, if you follow what he said was going to happen, everything has happened, and they are now in the process of rearming themselves with the Chinese, and they're practicing, they tell a joint exercise, and they're practicing that we will rain nuclear weapons. This is just this earlier this year. Rain nuclear weapons to destroy Los Angeles, Chicago, you know, 100 cities on the Americans if they try to stop us from what we're planning to do. Okay.
Chinese general.
Huh? Yeah, Chinese general. In fact, he's number two. He said that same thing about 6 years ago, and then he got promoted, so now he's... Okay. We can spend a lot of time on that. What's sad is that in the past, the United States was always technologically superior to the Russians and the Chinese and everybody in the world in every weapons category. Well, since the last 12 years, we have lost that edge. The Russians now have, and the Chinese are sharing with the Chinese, they now have a superior weapons in every major weapon category that there is. They have better submarines, better fighters, and in production. They have stuff in production better than what we have on the drawing board. Funny, it looks just like the one we have on the drawing board. They have better missiles. While we're disarming and disabling our nuclear ICBMs, they're building at three a month. Okay?
And we're paying them
to do that. In our SALT II treaties, they basically said, what we'll do is we'll get rid of all of our old stuff, which won't count in the new stuff. And we said, okay, we'll accept that. And so we haven't built anything. They've come out with three new fighters. They've come out with a new nuclear submarine, attack submarine. To give you another idea, they've got a torpedo that goes 300 miles an hour. The fastest ours goes is about 80, isn't it? 80? 60, 80 knots. They have one that goes 300, et cetera. I used to even to say that they had us on every category except one. We still had the best tank. The Abrams used to be the best tank. No longer. That was about 4 years ago. We lost that one as well. And so, yes.
Well, you know, we're supposed to all be reading the scriptures. And the Lord said that if we don't obey his commandments, that he will destroy us.
That's right.
And it also tells you how he's going to do that. He said he would empower other nations to come upon us.
That's right.
That's a pretty scary statement from the Lord.
Yeah.
So in other words, he's going to give them the technology that it takes to overcome what is going to need to be to destroy us. He's going to give our enemies that technology and whatever else.
High-powered Lamanites.
Exactly. All right, now, so, have we had the 13-month war yet?
No.
No. Trust me, we haven't, okay? What's interesting, so we're right here, okay? We're somewhere just getting close. So what we've been trying to do is find out what are some of the signs of the events that lead up just prior to the 51st war so we get an idea of how close we might be getting to that. We see the Russians and the Chinese preparing. Actually, the Chinese have set three different dates. They've kept moving them back a little bit on the attack of the United States. The first one was between 2005 and 2007. Okay? They've moved that back to 2008 to 2012.
The Olympics. They
want to
have the Olympics.
They want to have the Olympics. Okay? We're approximately right here. What's interesting is that people say, well, how come our prophets have never warned us about that? Well, they have, but we're not listening. For example, we got a quote by Harold E. Lee. He talks about a statement and a prophecy made by George Q. Cannon, with David O. McCabe sitting there. And basically says, when the atomic bombs start hitting America, I've told my family to get out of the city and go out on the farm and wait until it's over.
Grantsville,
actually.
That's J.R.B. Clark said that.
Huh?
Wasn't that J.R.B. Clark that said that?
Oh, J.R.B. Clark. Yeah. What did I say? Cannon?
George and Cannon.
Okay, it was J.R.B. Clark. At his 90th birthday, okay, he said that. And then you have Bruce R. McConkie, who's talking about the nuclear holocaust in General Conference as well. It's there. But people want to ignore it because it's hard stuff. It's fine.
When that was,
79.
Yeah.
And therefore that surely shall be.
Yeah, sure, yes.
What about this whole date thing with the Chinese? I mean, that falling in line with cold sensitive
and could be. The key thing is that there's some guys who really are really been tracking that now almost every day, watching what they're saying along this line, not, you know, watching what they're doing, not necessarily what they're saying. What's interesting is that they're saying kind of what they're doing. They're building up weapons across the Straits of Taiwan. They now have nuclear submarines, and they now have some missiles that are designed only to sink U.S. aircraft carriers. They have getting new weapons, etc., and it's all designed as anti-U.S. In fact, there was a good article earlier or late last week that said that, you know, they just broke a Chinese spy ring in Los Angeles, all right? And one of the things they learned from that spy ring is that, the Chinese now can track any and all of our submarines anywhere they go. So they could just plop one little nuke, and that's it. It's over. In that area. They can hit any submarine of ours anytime they want. Anyway.
No, China has also invested a tremendous amount of research and energy in the development of nano super weapons.
That's right. We're not doing anything.
If you can carry a nuclear device in your purse.
Yeah.
And which has been an enemy stop the people from coming in through the...
Who do you think is funding Osama bin Laden?
China.
Russia. They're giving them the money, they're giving them the arms, yeah. They're giving them the means, etc., to carry on the war. Okay? Gotta get the weapons from someplace, and that's where they're getting them from.
Yeah, curious different people, such as like J.R.
Likewise, yes.
Where they're using, this is the first phase of warfare against us, where they're using proxy agents.
That's correct.
Against the United States, but it's eventually going to shift into overt, armed conflict between the two nations.
Okay. Let's see. Survive through this period of time. Now, this time is actually written about by a lot of prophets and apostles. This period of time in the war, just before it and a little bit afterward, was described by Joseph Smith, Orson Pratt, Orson Hyde, Wilford Woodruff, Brigham Young, Parley P. Pratt, Ballard. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Joseph Fielding Smith wrote about it. Joseph S. Smith wrote about it. And now we have President Hinckley talking about it more and more, except on this line. So it's actually, we can't have a lot of detail about how bad it's going to be. John Taylor wrote about an extensive vision of what he described it, and it's ugly. Ugly, ugly. All right. Now, one of the things that we've used is to try to say, okay, yeah, but what happens? What's the sequence? So we now go from those sources down to what we would call third-level sources. These are like the dreams and visions of the people. So, according to the dreams and visions of people who commented and talked to me, I can give you what I believe to be a general scenario. Now, remember, I've been doing this for about 8 years, 8 or 9 years now, for about the dreams and visions.
How many dreams and visions do you think you've listened to?
About 600 or 700. In fact, I got someone who's already come up to me here and says, I got two more for you. Okay. In fact, we'll do it. We'll talk a little bit. We'll do it by hands. Let me tell you the things that happened, and then we'll do a little survey. Okay. According to the dreams and visions that I've read, I said three categories. What appears to happen is these three things. And they start about the same time, and they go happen at they get increased. So, let's say this is the war. The war has an attack, a sneak attack on the United States. According to George Albert Smith, George Albert Smith. Said it's been a long time since I've done this kind of stuff. George Albert Smith, the attack would come on a holiday at the very end of a election year.
Before the president takes the oath of office.
After the president has been elected, but before he takes the oath of office on a holiday. And what's interesting, he says specifically, is that that president would be of Greek extraction. Prior to that, all the presidents would be of Northern European or European ancestry. But this one is different because he's Greek. Extraction. I've had that verified. Okay. And I've actually talked to the person several times. His name was David Horn, who actually was the board president for that. Yes.
Earthquake.
series of earthquakes, but a couple of big ones here. And a flood. And a big flood. A wall of water about 50 to 100 feet tall. What it appears from all the descriptions is what the valley, the Wasatch Front, drops about 100 to 200 feet. And the Lake Bonneville comes back in a big hurry. That's what it appears like. The earthquake is big enough that the mountains between Brigham City and Logan, for example, are the, what do they call, Wellsville Mountains, shake down. They're no longer there. Okay. A lot of the mountains are shake down. New topography. In fact, it's interesting. The first time I did a lecture up in Logan, we were in the basement of this motel. About 100 people in this room, about half this size. We're just crowded in there. We were about 2 o'clock in the morning. We were sitting there talking about these things. And what was interesting is that when I mentioned the floods and the earthquakes, I said, yeah, we've seen that. There was enough people that they discussed among themselves that they had seen those events. I said, yeah, we got a question. What's your question? And he said, what do you do with your food storage? We've all seen the earthquake. We've all seen the flood. We all see that we're about 50 feet underwater, right where we're standing right now. So what do we do with our food storage in a flood? That's a good question. What have you guys been doing with it lately? Well, one of the guys said, a lot of us have been burying it. Okay. But we don't know if that's going to be good because we don't know how long the flood lasts. Well, I've been in other places. I said, well, apparently for everybody else, the flood only lasts about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, and then it's gone. Just enough to wipe things off and clean things off from the earthquake. The earthquake is so strong that what you see is mostly rubble about 3 feet high. A few buildings standing here and there, not very many, just piles of rubble. It's a big one. And on a scale of 1 to 10, it's like 11. It's a real doozy. Okay. On the slide. So one guy in the back, raises up, he says, hey, I got to tell you this. He says, they said, oh, we're burying it. I said, well, that seems to be a good idea. The guy says, I own a farm. He says, I've never had one of those dreams you talked about, but my neighbor has. He's got another farm. And so I've been burying my stuff on my property. I've got 130 acres or whatever. And so I'm burying on mine. But he, because he's had the dream of the water, he decided to go up one of these side canyons and put his food storage up above the water line. Okay, and so he said, so he went up to one of the side canyons. He says he went up there, found a big rock or whatever, said, oh, moved over about 100 feet and sunk a hole 6 feet deep, and guess what he ran into? Somebody else's food storage. The reaction was about the same. So what did he do? He figured it was a good place. He just moved over, another 50 feet and put his down. Figured maybe a good stop. You'd be surprised. People are having these kind of dreams, okay? The third, that's category two, natural calamities, disasters, earthquakes, things like that happening everywhere. Category three, or category C, is the invasion stuff. Armies, planes, parachutes, Chinese, stuff along this line. Yeah. Yeah. The economy, along with this, the economy, maybe I just mentioned this energy, the economy goes kaput. Yeah.
I've had this mention to me before about the idea of that flood, and I'd like to just throw something out for suggestion here. I'm sure you're well aware of Old Testament symbolism, right?
Uh-huh.
I think Isaiah uses the symbolism of the flood to represent invading armies. I'd just like to suggest as a possibility, a symbolic
possible. There are multiple places, you can do that. Isaiah does talk actually more than most people realize about America, the Gentile nation. We're talking with Tom about Isaiah. What I think
he's talking about scriptural symbolism.
Uh-huh.
You're talking about dreams.
Yeah.
You get the same symbolism in dreams, or dreams more literal.
I mean, Joseph. Joseph.
But, the dream of itself was symbolic, but right. the events were actual.
Right.
Okay.
So I'm just suggesting that sometimes there could be symbolic elements in dreams and sometimes literal elements.
Okay. That's possible. However, there seems to be some scripture to back this one up. Okay. That our interpretation.
Yeah. I'm just putting it on.
But you know, what's unique about scriptures and about any symbolism, parables or whatever, there are multiple interpretations which could all be true of the same event or the same action. Okay. Which is what we all call a type and shadows, a type and shadows, a type and shadows. Okay. Let's see. If you read Revelation chapter 12, it talks about a flood. So, the church goes into the church goes in the wilderness. There's two times that the woman goes into the wilderness. Okay, in Revelation chapter 12. All right. The second time, my opinion, of course, it's not worth anything, so don't worry about it. Is that according to Brigham Young, the church went into the wilderness when it moved to Salt Lake. The scripture called it the Salt Lake Wilderness. According to that time, three and a half years, moved to get away from it, and then the Satan came after 3.5 years. So we actually were, when I was working at church headquarters at the time, working on that, we were saying, what does that really mean? We felt the Spirit say that was the Salt Lake Wilderness. The wilderness that is described there is the Salt Lake Wilderness. The church moves out from the world, out of the wilderness. And Satan follows it. Okay? And so we actually went over to the library, and the head of the library at church headquarters is President Kimball's son. So we got Brother Kimball worked on this, and there was about four or five of us standing around trying to do research. And the question was, what event happened 3.5 years after the saints came to Utah? Okay? And an event so powerful enough, it changed the history of the people, and it was basically like evil. Right? And Brigham Young said, give me 10 years alone in the wilderness and we'll have a Zion-type people. Guess how long he got? 3.5 years. We first thought it was Johnson's army, but Johnson's army actually came 4 years later. Okay? 4 years later. What did happen almost to the exact day was they declared Utah a territory on 3.5 years to the day. That meant that instead of the people of Utah electing their people, guess who was going to be sent out for? Appointed by the government. And they could not control themselves. And so within a week, there was two judges sent to Utah, corrupt as all get out. They came here, spent about 3 months here, and came back and reported that the Mormons were in rebellion against the United States, etc. along this line. And because of their report, they sent out Johnston's army. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, it said that he would then chase and cleanse that area by a flood. Satan would try to destroy with a flood. Now, it's interesting if you go to Isaiah chapter 4. We have to tie them together. Isaiah chapter 4, chapter 3 describes Jerusalem and Zion. And they're both going to be cleansed. First half of that chapter, chapter 3, verses 1 through about 15, if I remember right, is the destruction and the cleansing of Jerusalem. The second half of that chapter, starting, I think it's about verse 16, is a very famous one called, it starts off, Daughters of Zion. Okay? Where it describes how the daughters of Zion, the women of the church, according to Wilford Woodruff and Ezra Taft Benson, that it refers primarily to the women of the church in North America who don't keep the covenants and the commandments. And so in this, they describes how they're going to be left desolate and destroyed, and the cities burned around them. And their men will be killed in the war. So we have, interesting now, in chapter 4, starting in verse 2, it comes off and says that Anyway, take time to do that. In verse 2, it starts off by saying that there, the two groups have been who survived. Those who survived those two cleansings are now holy and sacred and pure. Okay, the first group, Jerusalem, survived by burning. Okay, remember they have the War of Armageddon, which we haven't even talked about yet. The other group survived, were cleansed by, take a guess, washing. That's why I put those two together, and it seems to hold together. Okay. Long answer for a simple question. Okay. Yes.
Wondering about the water here in the Salt Lake Valley. Everybody thinks we're short of it. They've been drilling some wells in our neighborhood, and the people that have been drilling the wells say that they have drilled through three great big rivers underground.
Well, there was an 1960s, early 60s, there was an archaeologist, not archaeologist, but there was a geologist who came out and said, he came out with the theory, and because he wasn't some big famous guy, but it hit the news, it was, in the newspapers, but he basically said, there appears to be a freshwater, take the freshwater that's up in Canada, Montana, through that area, and there appears to be what used to be Old Lake Bonneville, and used to come down and flow down into the Gulf of California. He says, the question they started with was, where is the fresh water in the Gulf of California coming from? It surely isn't the Colorado River, okay? And because, if you study, that's one of the interesting places that's half salt water, half fresh water through there. And so they actually said, calculate the amount of water that's fresh water produced up in Canada and stuff. And they said it appears to be the old Bonneville River is sunk underground. And actually that got published. And so that was the theory. It's just, a couple hundred feet underground. Nobody bothers with it along this line. Maybe 500,000 feet. But what appears in all the dreams and visions and the near-death experiences, et cetera, is that the ground drops, where water comes up, and everything gets washed really good. Okay, all the rubble gets washed away. All right. Now, some other things that seem to happen right here is that is just immediately prior to let me put it this way. Let me give you what appears to be the timetable of that year. Give or take 6 months or so. Okay? And we have arguments, discussions about could that happen in 2007. And the year 2008 appears to go this way. One of the things also is people have dreams and visions about places of refuge, places of safety. We call tent cities. In fact, the First Presidency published some stuff in 1886 about that, what kind of places. Brigham Young talked about them, those kind of places. Yes, he did. Yeah, Brigham Young talked about several times in reference that when tents will get hard, the Lord's going to command, to your tents, O Israel, leave the world behind.
Well, can you think you figured it?
Well, not with all the stuff surrounding it. No. Anyway, it goes this way. Sometime in the spring of that year, things are hard. I also got this quote by an apostle at a state's conference in 1971 in Georgia. Okay. This is Marky Peterson in a priesthood session talking about home teaching. That's a person who, one of these guys who write in a journal, take the notes in the journal. I wish I could do that. But he would open his journal and read it to me. He said, well, I want to read to you what Marky Peterson said. So he said, there will come a time when things will be bad. It won't be real bad, but it'll be bad. There'll be a lot of people out of work. There'll be calamities around us. Okay? He says, the prophet will call, or the church leaders will call, and Harold B. Lee kind of mentioned this, sort of. They'll tell you when to go and where to go, so don't worry about it until then. He said, they'll all of a sudden, out of an all the dreams, visions, see that there'll be a sacrament meeting. There'll be a referred letter from the First Presidency. Basically, after sacrament, the meeting, rest of the meeting is canceled. We're holding special televised meetings at, you know, this afternoon. And so those who have a one-year supply of food are invited to come to the Stake Center and listen to this meeting, this broadcast. If you don't have a year supply, you're not invited.
Are you still quoting Frederick Griffin, Elder Peterson?
No, this is this combination. I'll tell you Elder Peterson's exact quotes in a little bit. This is more detailed than he said. He basically said there'll come a time when from the prophet to the regional, to the form of the 12, to the regional representatives, because that's what it was in those times, to the state presidents, to the bishops, to the home teachers. And that's what scared him. He says, my life's going to depend on my home teacher visiting me.
Right.
That they will be invited out to bring your family, your tents, and the church will provide vehicles to bring your food. And that you'll be invited to go camping for a year to a place of safety and refuge.
That's Marky Peterson that said that.
That's Marky Peterson who said that. Okay? And he was trying to emphasize the importance of home teachers. He said, now, and then he started, once he opened that subject, he went on to say, he said, now, even though I'm standing here telling you, brethren, about this, most of the members of this state will not go. There'll be only a very small group will leave. He says, then there'll be another group about the same size that will try to leave a few days later. They're not ready to go on 24 hours notice. They will leave a few days, maybe a week or two later. I hope you make it, was his comment. I hope you make it. Okay? He said, but the vast majority of you will not go. Will not go.
Well, I remember you saying this several years ago, and I was wondering, maybe Lord Clifford was going to be the one who was going to be driving that truck or a special assignment. And I remember reading during Katrina that right under the Deseret Industries, the church has the Deseret Transport. And these are professional drivers, and that's all they do. And that's exactly what they did in New Orleans. They came and they bailed the members of the church out, took their food storage, and went to higher ground.
Yeah, and
that is the type and shadow.
What the church delivered was tents, personal hygiene kits, and some communication gear and sleeping bags and stuff.
They didn't bring much food.
Okay, food was already there for some of the members. Okay. Interesting. Yes.
I'm just thinking about all the people that have food storage that's like 10, 15 years old. It's, you know, people say if you have your year supply, and it's like, oh, I wonder if it's still good.
Okay. Yeah.
Sprout your wheat.
Well, can people find? Yeah. Try sprouting.
The classes have started using it now.
Yeah. Anyway, so that appears to happen in the late spring. Since if this was the year, for example, if this was Christmas, all right? So this is the year we're talking about. This is spring. So that happens in the spring, early summer. People get up there, they get the camps organized, etc. along this line. Some people who do have food storage don't go because they don't want to go because they have a job. Why leave? It takes considerable. Think about this. What would happen if the prophet said next Sunday, drop everything, quit your work, walk away from your house, lock the door. Oh, the other thing is you have to be debt-free, except for your house.
Except for your house.
Because the house is the collateral for your loan. But if you're not debt-free, I don't think you can go. Period, you can't go. Okay? So you got to be food storage and debt-free. So what has been President Hinckley's been encouraging for the last several years? Getting out of debt. I wonder why. What does he know that we don't?
Why? Do you have any idea why? Is it because it's a legal problem?
Keep
authorities of the United States away from us? So we go out there with credit cards in, they'll hunt us down.
That's exactly right. With the new credit card law, fraud law, and I think bankruptcy law they just passed, they have left the door wide open to go up and throw you in jail for not paying.
And why not a mortgage? Because they can repossess the home. And
the home is the full collateral for it. Nothing else is.
Okay.
Okay.
So any debt that's secured, if you just leave?
Well, not necessarily. For example, I can tell you what happened with my car. I lost my job. I had a car. And so I voluntarily turned it in thinking that would be great. So they then turned around and sold it and then sent me a bill for another $6,000. Okay. Well, I thought the car was a collateral. Oh, I'm sorry. And you drove it off the lot and dropped in value. So we turned around and sold it to one of the guys on the lot for cheap. So you still owe us $6,000. Eventually, I had to pay that off.
What if you use like a Discover card, but every month you pay it off just to be getting the Sky Miles? So you're about, say, $1,500 in debt at the end of the month, you pay it. Next month, $1,500.
As long as you can walk away from
you're
it,
not dead,
you're not dead.
But if you're called out in 24 hours, you might not be able to pay that last $1,500.
Thank you.
let's suppose, you know, we're saying that we have an increasing economic collapse here. More and more people are out of work and out of work and out of work. Okay. If you own your own home, how much mortgage do you have to, are you tied to?
The taxes.
Nothing. Okay. You're only paying with the taxes. Okay. But you can do that. If you have to go work at McDonald's or Walmart, like most everybody has to, it looks like. Okay. Then you can probably still survive. But if you go beyond that, if you still, if you look, the mortgage up to the hill, and you lose a job or you get cut in pay, you lose your house. And so, very good wise to say, hey, during that period of run-up time, great if you don't owe anything except just taxes on the line. Okay? So if you can't pay up your house, do so. Always good advice. Okay? All right.
Back to where you say, though, you're only invited to go if you're out of debt or out of resources. That's
yeah.
Where we got off the tangent.
Yeah. Okay?
That's what these dreams see, that you have to
yeah.
Be out of debt.
All right. You get up there. They get up there. Some people say it's too hard. They can't live that way. They can't live without CSI and television. So they leave. A few leave. Natural disasters increase tremendously during this period of time. You have at somewhere about this time, it appears that the church becomes illegal. Don't know why. We can make some guesses. But the church appears to be determined to be illegal. And they close the temples. They close the churches. Close the meeting houses. Okay?
Still the spring?
Apps, during the summer sometime. Things start to go, after the group leaves, things go downhill very, very fast. And then all of a sudden, somewhere near the end of summer, the beginning of fall, right here, several things happen all the same time within a few weeks of each other. First of all, whereas before there was increasing food, lack of food, and more you had to go for the government to get your food. All of a sudden, there is no food. None at all for anybody. Not for the government, not for anybody. Okay, second. Okay, electricity gets turned off. Period. It's gone. There is no electricity. Okay, third thing that happens. Appears to be a major biological attack on the United States. We know of at least four of the cities. We think we know at least four of the cities. In the Dreams and Visions, it's San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and the Olympic City, Salt Lake.
It's now today. It was in a magazine. Saying Salt Lake is a very gay-friendly city.
Oh, it is.
That's amazing. ASL, really great.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Salt Lake is now... guess who they, you know, it shows who they elect. When the population, what does it say in the Book of Mormon? When they're wicked enough to elect wicked leaders, then they're ready for?
Destruction.
Yeah, okay. Rest my case. All right. Look at Rocky. Good old Rocky. Okay. aren't you glad you don't live the cave? And the fourth thing that seems to happen right there, same, within weeks of each other, is a very severe winter sets in all across the United States, and it's a little doozy. So you have all
this
those four things.
This is before the spring?
Oh, this is after the spring, just at the fall. Okay, right after, no, it's an early winter. It's a Montana winter, what it describes like. You got 10 feet of snow, even down in Florida, it's cold, sub-zero. You got 10 feet of snow everywhere. The mountains, of course, you got more. It's bitter cold. There is no electricity. There is no gasoline. There is no food. And some of the Dreams and Scriptures are digging in, and trying to dig in the frozen ground to find worms to eat. Okay? Yes.
Now, we've already left, right?
Yes.
Before this long winter.
That's right. Now, what appears to happen is when the group leaves, the world and most of the church, 90% of the church, laugh at them, say they're idiots and fools. In fact, some of them say, as they're gathering at the state centers to caravan out, there are people lying, members of the church lining there, you know, laughing at them, saying, you guys are idiots to leave your home and family like this. Why are you following this man, the prophet, and the form of the 12? They don't give you any reason. You're just leaving. You're idiots. And they'll even quote scripture. They'll even quote scripture saying, you know, if they say, go out to the desert, go up the mountains, don't go. They'll do all that kind of stuff. And what happens if they leave, then the church, those who are remaining, start arguing about who's going to be leading the church. Okay, it becomes very interesting. Okay, yes?
That sounds like the great spacious building with people mocking and maybe some people will change their mind and decide, well, maybe they're right.
Yeah. Well, after there's no food, no cold, etc. on this line, guess where everybody would like to go? But they can't get to them because of the snow. They don't have any gas. There's plagues everywhere. Okay? Etc. on this line. Yeah, the biological attacks. Okay, purple spots. First one, the first part of the plague is white spots, about the size of a dime and a quarter, and it kills a lot of people. The second plague comes a little bit later, is the purple spots, kills much, much faster. The other one kills in 3 or 4 days, not a lot of people, but some. The other one kills a lot more people, much, much faster. But in all the descriptions of all the plagues, the famine, the earthquakes, the floods, everything, the winter, the thing that kills more people than everything else combined are the mobs. There are gangs that go absolutely berserk.
Sounds a little bit like the Arabs right now.
Yeah, yeah. And roaming armies, according to John Taylor and Orson Pratt, roaming armies, state to state, city to city.
How do they get around if there's no gas? Things block.
Well, they, or they steal it, or they, grab it, whatever.
Read the last Babylon.
Yeah, yeah. And from the description, at first they kill people for gasoline or food or clothing, something like that. But then later on, they become animals and they just kill for the joy of killing. It looks like right out of the Book of Mormon, which we're getting into in that section in a little while. They're on the reading schedule. And so they go berserk. Now, what's interesting is that the camps are, there's camps of 300, there's camps of several thousand. The church, by the way, is building those places right now. Over 100 of them being built.
100 in what? All the United States are in a certain state.
Primarily in the Rocky Mountain area.
Over 100 of them.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a list of those?
Sort of.
Everybody talks about the one east of Heber. Is that one?
Well, that's the one that has the most publicity about. I know personally about a dozen. And so they actually have a church quote by a church official said the church actually building over 100 of these camps. Okay.
I guess it's hard to get some girls' camps.
They call them girls' camps. Girls and family camps. Okay.
It's hard for a lot of people when you tell them this to believe that all of this is going on secretly behind the scenes and the members don't know it. You know,
it's right from their face. Where's the best place to hide a needle? And a bunch of other needles. You know? And so, for example, let's go girls camp. Let's talk about the Heber City because it's been publicized, so I don't feel bad about talking about that one. And it's not the largest by far. It's one of those 10 times larger than the one up in Heber. The girls Heber camp is 8,000 acres. It's the second largest, most expensive construction project the church has ever undertaken.
The one in Heber.
The largest construction project, or most expensive, was what?
Conference
Center. Okay. Now, so they built, because why? They had to build their own complete sewer treatment plant. So how many people, girls, can this hold? 22,000 girls is what the plant can handle. Okay. Now, would you say that's overbuilding a little bit? Yeah. Well, it gets worse because you say, how long do girls go to girls' camp?
A week.
All right. So you have 12 weeks during the summer. 12 times 22,000 is what? You got about 360,000 girls who go. There aren't 360,000 girls who go to girls' camp in the entire state of Utah. And they just are building another one with 6,000 acres in Vernal. You can fit the whole town in it. Okay. You've got another 4,000, they're all over the place like that. Okay? Does that come in?
Yeah.
But they are girls' camps. No doubt about it. But could they, it was interesting, I had one person come to me and says, I've actually worked on those projects. I was the one who sat in front of the first presidency every week and we talked about setting these girls' camps. And they just said, we need to do this and somebody donated this and we'll turn to girls' camp. What am I going to do with this. I'll turn that to the girls, Cam. Not once did he ever mention in his ear about, we're going to use that for a place of refuge in the last day. And so I asked him, I said, okay. Now, you know about how many of these they're going, right? I said, yeah. I said, could the church, in a time of need, use those for places of refuge? And he said, beyond a shadow of a doubt. Yeah.
I just got released from being up there as a naturalist for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And we never heard one word
right.
from anyone. And Chris Hinckley, his wife's, Marjorie Payne Hinckley, her camp is going to be opened in June, and his family's going to be coming up there as the first campers
yeah. Yeah.
to be up there. And I thought, you know, I'd like to go up there and ask, you know, do you think this? I know that there's a 10-year supply of wood, and that the water is perfectly pure. No chlorine added, nothing is added.
But
they said that they can never hold enough fields because from the area that it draws, which is 4 hours away, that we are creating 10 stakes every year, and it will never be able for every person that would like to go up there.
I know the girls' camp that's not more than 120 miles that can handle 300,000 people. They just put a water line on it. We talked about this, Doug. Where did it go?
Because
2 foot water line. Now, how many people a 2 foot main water line will handle? Close to 500,000. Okay. But what's interesting is they covered it up and nobody ever knows about this. We knew because we had a couple of our people drive by and say, that's interesting. Why are they putting a water line out in the middle of absolutely nowhere? And they said, well, they're going to have to stop the freeway and stuff like that, punch it, you know, and put it across. They punched it underneath, covered it all up, and in a year or two, no one will ever know it's there.
So what I'm going to say, you know, when we talk about self-sufficiency,
yeah.
In reality, we're not. The church is going to be doing so much for us.
Well, yes, but what did the church say about the food storage? The church has probably got grain silos all over the place, but who were they for?
Widows. So it's almost like, look, you take care of the command of food storage and we'll help you with the rest.
That's it. Now, it says, you know, get your primary one, get your basic food storage. And then after that, other necessities that would allow you to live a year without any help or anything else. Okay? I got quotes from President Benson who talks about getting a gun to protect it. Ellen Tanner also talked about that. You need to have a weapon to protect your family and your food storage.
Well, why would we need that in Tent City?
Well, you probably won't have to use it, but if you have a group of, say, 22,000, and you've got about, you know, 4,000 or 5,000, you know, deer rifles up there.
No one's going to try.
No one's going to bother.
Okay. We won't all need one of those. Our family hasn't owned a gun in 3 generations.
Okay. So...
I
well, trust me, I think if you go out there, there might be enough guys. We do have enough guns in our
cooking.
Yeah, to stockpile. And I know guys who've got rooms full of guns to loan you one for the night. Yes, but good to see you guys.
I just had a concern that my brother
tonight
thought of. When we get called out to these tent cities, and it's supposed to be an extremely harsh winter or 10 feet of snow, how are you supposed to live in 10 feet of snow in a tent? I mean, where are you going to...
Come on to my house. Okay.
But there's not a tent on this planet that can hold 10 feet of snow.
It never happens one night. You know, when you go out, see, and this is what you do. You go out, and as you get a foot or two of snow, just knock it off. It's real easy on a tent.
But that's got to build up someplace.
Oh, on the side, and you shovel it away. Okay?
But at the camp of...
Have you ever snow camped in 10 feet of snow?
Well, yeah, but that's just 10 people max.
Okay.
You have a whole city of people. You have a whole city of snow.
You need to come up to a Klondike up in Montana. 10 feet of snow, 20 below zero, good stuff. Okay?
You guys build snow camps or have igloos?
Yeah.
What?
One of those.
Karsten Vision, she said she saw vast piles of coal and timbers for future use to build.
Yeah.
So couldn't the shelters be constructed?
my opinion is, I think, or we think, kind of a group of us, we think we know about that much. There's about that much to know, okay? We've just got a few inklings of what's coming enough to say, okay, I got to be prepared for a hard winter. I got to be prepared for a, you know, the church will probably, well, it appears that the church will provide a tent. If you want to have your own tent that's insulated, then bring your own. And so we've got, you know, on our website, we discuss all sorts of ways to, you know, the cheap way to do it, that's my specialty, and the, you know, the expensive way to buy an insulated tent, do all this kind of stuff on this line. And so that's one of the things we discuss back and forth. And for example, what happens if you have a broken leg? Dentistry problems. You know, sanitation, you know, how fast do you run out of toilet paper? There's a group up in Logan that said, you know, after they were started exploring some of these things, they've actually held camps, you know, for a couple weeks at a time to say, all right, what are we learning here? One of the things, the interesting thing they learned is, okay, we build a fire. But they said, you know, we built the fire, remember this? We built the fire on the ground and our backs were hurting after the first day. So we built, you know, little mounds and so up here so we can almost stand like this and cook on the fire and have like a fire pit, but it's a raised fire pit. It made a world of difference. Little things like that make a big difference. So there are lots of little tricks along that line.
Are we committed to having your supply of toilet paper?
No. So we basically researched it and said, okay, you know, what did the pioneers use? Did you ever think about that? When was toilet paper invented? Long after the pioneers moved to Salt Lake City. So what did the pioneers use? Well, they used mullein. They used besides the natural stuff, they actually had three pieces of cloth. Okay? And you had one that was drying, one that was ready for use, and one that might be soiled waiting to be rinsed out.
So what?
And so they actually got together and sewed toilet paper together. You know, but it was actually cloth, yes. Smears too much. Trust me.
Wipe it first.
When I went on a mission to Chile, when I got down there, there was no toilet paper, there was no toothpaste, except along this line. It was during the revolution with Allende. And so, some of those necessities of life were not there. It was very interesting. So, yes, it's smear. But what they found is that the slick magazines, okay, what you do is you wet them first, and then they become wonderful, you know, and so, in fact, there's a camp going on right tomorrow, they're practicing a little winter camp up by
Morgan,
yeah.
I suppose instead of today, you can probably take a motorhome.
Yeah, in fact, it was interesting, I was out in Oklahoma City and doing a lecture, and he was saying, so, you know, on these rooms of vision, they see all these tents up there, and the member of the state presidency was there and says, and one motorhome, because that's why I bought it, because I've had a dream of vision, or I'm taking my Airstream up there. You know, so it's going to be tents and an Airstream, at least one, because I'll be there. Kind of stuff. Yes?
I'm glad to know that the state president has the motorhome, because I said to Don, are you going to give your motorhome to the state president? And I said, no, the state president makes more money than we do.
Yes.
And I said, well, you can handle that probably and call him to be the state president if you want the state president to live in a motorhome.
My question has to do with families. Like our daughter's in another ward. She has her year's supply. And we have
okay.
That we share.
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer to it. The answer is, what if my daughter's in another ward or another state, whatever, and the call comes, can we ever get together? And I don't have an answer to that. Okay? Maybe, maybe not. Okay. There's one bishop I know who's very into food, you know, stuff, and he basically says, listen, when the call comes, I want you and you and you and you, because I know you've got 4 years of stuff, and you've got a machine shop, and you've got a wood shop all ready to go, packed and ready to go, kind of stuff like that. He says, I want all you guys who've been practicing this for about 5 or 6 years, I want you in my ward. So we go all together, you know, on this line. So I'll make you honorary members of the what Logan Ward, there that is up there. Okay, yes.
In answer to what he said earlier, the prophet did not tell us to store your supply of toilet paper.
Yes.
But
is, he also warns us, don't go overboard. For example, if I said, you know, it would be prudent to get a gun. Well, then people say, great, I got to go out and get a machine gun and a tank and a flamethrower and all that kind of stuff. That's a little bit overboard. That's what exactly he doesn't want to happen.
No, no, okay. Just justify to your wife.
I just blew that one up. Okay. You know, what's reasonable and prudent? Okay, that's for each individual to figure out for themselves.
You're diabetic, it's a lot of insulin.
Yeah, if diabetic, you're a lot of insulin. Or learn to treat it with herbs. And I know people who have diabetes who cured it with herbs, so it can be done. Okay? It's not easy. You have to be on it all the time. Okay? Diet. Question?
Well, I was just thinking about 10 feet of snow, you know, that'd be a great source of water that could be melted and utilized.
Yeah.
And it didn't take Nephi very long after splitting off from his brothers to start making weapons.
Yeah. So there's, you know, those, you know, think it through. That's the bottom line, is think it through. You're going to be in a, and people, the other thing about tents, if you're going to go tent, it needs to be a real four-season tent. Not one of these Walmart jobs you go down there and buy for $35 or $45. It's a one-season tent. Those tents, those nylon kind of tents, are designed to last 90 days in the sunlight. Now, for most everybody in the world, that's terrific, because you, what do? Well, the summer you take it out, stand it for 2 weeks, you put it away. Next summer you take it out, you spend another 2 or 3 weeks in it, put it away. Next summer, so maybe 3 seasons, and now it starts breaking down. But in a solid tent where you're out in the sun, 90, you know, it'll disintegrate within about 3 weeks.
Four weeks. I've looked, and I can't find anything but those nylon tents. Where do you really get the heavy-duty canvas?
Well, now you need to go. Army Surplus is one. Smith and Edwards is another place. Online, Cabela's, the Outfitters, type in outfitting, and the old Outfitters, you know, the you know, what do they call, the log cabin tents on this line, gotta be canvas. Now, I can tell you a really cheap way, if you want to write this down, to do a tent. You're starting to laugh.
Wait. No, our neighbors have done it, it's great.
Okay, here's what you do. This is my cheap version of an insulated tent for under $500. Okay? It's a 10 by 20. You go down to your local, Costco, and you buy a carport. Heavy, you know, it's got a solid metal frame, got good canvas over it, 3-year canvas warranty on the canvas. You go down and buy it. That's $160 right there. Okay? Then you go down to your Powerbank store. And you buy a heavy-duty tarp, a good one, about 50 by 60, to put over that. That has a 5-year life, so you now have got protection. And so it comes out, looks like this. Here's your tent. Okay. All right. Then you put your tarp over it. What do you got? Well, you got insulation. Now, here's the ground. And so one of the nice things is that you now have a place to put your food storage. Suppose this is the sun over here. So you put your food storage back here. It's cool during the summer. Okay. And what happens is that because you put a rope from here straight down and kind of lean it on, and then you can roll this up. And if you have clear plastic here, what do you got? You got a greenhouse, sunroom, heat, okay, along this line. The other next thing you do is you go out and buy this bubble wrap, this silver bubble insulation. It comes in 4-foot length widths, and you can buy it in rolls of, you know, 20 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet along this line. And you basically roll it in along the inside here, along with duct tape, seal it together. The nice thing about this is that it has an R4 insulation factor, and it reflects 95 or 98% of the heat. So body heat just reflects back inside. The other nice thing about it is you flip one little flashlight on, because the silver reflects and you got a lot of light. Trust me, that makes a big difference during the dark winter.
Where do you find that stuff at?
Home Depot, Lowe's, any place like that. It's the silver belt, it's silver wrap insulation. And, you know, it's about quarter of an inch thick and has little bubbles on it. Yes.
The plastic. So you say you buy some thick plastic to use in the greenhouse underneath the tarp?
Yeah, I would always buy, I gotta tell you this, A lady wrote me from Denver. She said, my mother, who's been dead for 10 years, came back and visited me, in a dream I had. And she said, some hard times are coming. You must make sure that you have winter clothing and winter good hiking and winter boots for everyone and duct tape and plastic. And then she disappeared. She wanted to talk to her mom. Her mom says, get duct tape and plastic? great message from heaven, all right? What could I do with duct tape and plastic? As my family can tell you, you can build houses out of it, okay? You can do almost anything, okay? So I would take at least 3 rolls of black plastic, the 10-by-20-foot rolls, the 3-millimeter, and 3 rolls of clear. Black is great because inside this room at one end, here's the tent, okay, and the outside. Right, this corner off could be the bathroom. So you walk out the back, and here's your little potty room. Now, next thing that's really critical, it's my experience, 5-gallon buckets will be worth their weight in gold. Trust me on that. Yeah. Okay, 5-gallon buckets. You use them to haul water. You can sit on them and go potty. Okay? The only place you can get the lids for that to seal it are at Emergency Essentials. Well, the only place we found them. Okay? Now, what was that? Experience. I was working at church headquarters, and somebody invited me up to do a lecture, and I turned them down for a couple months, and finally said, come up and do fishing. So I said, my kids, I had a kid getting ready to go to the Philippines on a mission. I said, okay, I just got back on assignment from church headquarters down to South America for about 6 weeks. I was tired, and I said, great. So we will go up there on the little lecture. I can write off as a business trip to size. And the kids, my boys, my younger boys, were saying, Dad, we're going to go fishing again. It's been ages. So my wife saying, when are you going to take the boys fishing again? You're always too busy. I was in a bishopric. And so I went up there, and the Spirit said, move there. So we moved there. So within 6 months, we were starting to build our house. The first year we were there, we lived in a cabin about 300 feet from where we were building our house. The cabin was not finished. It had running water in the stream right in front. No toilets, no water inside. It had a propane stove. We lived that way for a year. Very, very educational. Okay? Literally, the boys went out in the morning and chopped holes in the ice, got the water and brought it in, and filtered it, and used it, whatever, on this line. We dug a latrine outside. We were a very special house because we had a 2-potty room, 2 buckets. You don't have to take them out every day. You can take them out every 3 days. But if you wait longer than 3 days, they get awfully full. If you drop them or spill them. Okay.
Where did you take them to?
We dug a latrine out down the house about every other day or so. One of the boys, the unlucky one, it was Daniel. My brother, he would take Daniel to the mission home. We figured he got called to Finland because he's from Montana, and Finland's not cold enough to bother him. Okay. They would take it out and dump it in the latrine, every other day. Come in, wash it off, bring a bucket of gunk and a bucket of water, and then dump that, wash it out, dump that like this, and come back in. Okay. What else? Flashlights, candles are invaluable. The best kind of candles you get are these the candles in the glass tubes that are kind of thin and tall. Okay, they're clear. Saint candles, Get the ones without the saint stuff or the hearts and things like that on it. They're really figured. If you can find them for 50 cents a piece, they're great. They last for about 10 days.
How about winding flashlights?
We have tried a lot of those. They don't last very long.
What happens to them?
They break.
What kind of candles and where?
Wherever you can find them. Look for the dollar stores. Every once in a while they'll bring a box of them in. They're the tall candles in the glass thing. Okay.
Have a bit.
the new rings at Plum Tree Mall, where King Celeste used to be.
Right.
Rings has gone in there, and they have a lot of them. And, but you know, you can put the Catholic stuff on.
Yeah, it's in that section. That's the best deal we found on candles. After Christmas, often you'll go to Walmart and they'll have big candles for sale. You know, the ones that are usually $15, you find them for $3 or $4. They're well worth it, you know, with the 4 weeks and stuff like that. Candles are really great.
Kerosene lamp.
No, actually, we don't like kerosene lamps. They really stink up the house, unless you get the really pure kerosene. But if you get the really pure kerosene, when it gets cold, it freezes. So it doesn't work very good. What we have found better than anything else are these LED flashlights. You get one LED flashlight or a couple of those things, and they last forever. Those, now, there are two kinds. There's the cheap kind, which you probably are selling, and there's the more expensive kind, which are around $20. $20 actually do pretty good. Yeah, they're fairly long, and you shake them up, but they're heavier duty. But they're about $20-$25. The regular size ones that are coming out now are fairly cheap, and they last about 3 days of shaking. So maybe
what breaks?
Huh?
What breaks?
The insides start falling apart. They're just not made very well to really last very long. Okay. But the original ones were really good. Okay.
If you have a fairly decent tent, couldn't you go, you said Cal Ranch, and get the 5-year warranty tarp and duct tape it all together and cover up your not-so-great tent so it wouldn't...
Yeah, in fact, that's what I say. Use that to cover over that, then you've got a double layer of insulation, and you protect it, so you've got now 10 years worth of stuff. It also will help on the snow, because now the snow goes off, and you have areas to actually work. On the inside... you could, on sunny days, you can actually roll this up and have clear plastic here, and you've got a solar room along this line. On the ends, you could cut windows or doors and put clear plastic in, you know. And the other thing about the silver stuff is it's very light. Now, there'll come a time that after the attack on the United States, then the invasion, and then the winter quits, okay, that the people in the tent cities pack up their tents, come down out of the mountains, you know, and the winter lasts until like June or July, which is normal Montana winter. And hey, we've had 2 feet of snow in June where we couldn't even get up to the house.
That's a period of time. How many years so far? What year, 2 years?
From here?
From the time we leave to the tent cities.
About a year.
Yeah, you want to go back to your scenario? We got to go up in the tent. You left us with a cold winter coming in.
Yeah.
10 feet of snow.
Yeah.
Where were we at?
Okay, then later on, it appears. Now, this is one of the questions we have. It either happens in that winter or maybe a little bit, yeah, we have discussions on this all the time. We don't know. There's the nuclear attack on the United States and then followed up by the invasion. During this winter time, my opinion is that it happens really quick. It seems to happen really quick. And then, so we come into the winter. And then the spring, there is no spring, and then we start in summer, and that's when the snow melts, and we take everybody who's, you know, there, we go down to the valleys, which have now been cleansed, and we start planting crops, because everybody else in the world now is coming out of this winter, who have survived over the winter, and now they're trying to make their way into where the crazy guys were, but they now have all the food and safety, okay, because the gangs are attacking, you know. In all the major cities, the way you don't want to be is in a major city. Look what happened in the little fact and shadow was, what, in New Orleans? It wasn't the water that got everybody, it was the gangs. Remember when they had to bring in help? They had to have police and National Guard escorts because they were getting shot at.
Well, it's funny you took my back, but I just remember when I read the first, or your article of all about the cities, and you talked about the things like that. There is scriptural back and forth in these places of refuge, which I thought was just fascinating. Now I can't read the scriptures without seeing
it. It's everywhere, isn't it? Yeah.
Just being led out. You know, Lehi was led away from Jerusalem. Nephi was told to leave his brother. Mosiah was told to leave
the land of Nephi.
There's so many, there's like,
yeah,
count after account where this is a scriptural scenario where the Lord accepts.
is the standard operating procedure for the Lord when a group of righteous people become wicked? You take the few righteous who are left and lead them out to a tent city. Okay. And that's standard operating procedure.
And again, again. Las Vegas, Ezekiel.
Oh, yeah.
We have, you know, the timeline that you're showing there, like 9 months before this attack, and over here you're talking about a 13-month war.
Well, the 13-month war starts somewhere in here. It doesn't start with us. It starts somewhere else, but it hits here in the United States really, really hard.
Okay, so the war itself can be 13 months, but the amount of time it actually affects the United States is within that time frame.
Yes, yeah, yeah, it appears to be, yes. Okay.
Okay.
So where do the men out of the mountains help
Gideon? There is a tremendous earthquake that happens there. Yeah, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's like a 20. The New Madrid Fault goes in a big time. Now, the largest earthquake ever recorded in the history of the United States, in fact, they say in some places the history of the world, is the one not associated with the volcano blowing up, but is the one that happened in the New Madrid Fault in the 1811. It actually, it was so strong, the Mississippi River flowed backwards for 3 days. The bells rang violently in Boston, what, 1,500 miles away or something like that. It lasted for a couple of months. Huge shaking. Changed the land everywhere.
Shaking lasted for a couple of months?
Yeah, off and on.
The aftershocks lasted for months and months and months.
It was horrendous. They don't even call it a quake. It doesn't even put on the quake scale. They call it a super quake. They don't even put it on the Richter scale. And it appears, yeah, that's a document covering section 103. And what happens is that the earthquake happens, and then the water comes in, and the whole land just drops for miles around, and the water comes in from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to the Great Lakes, because one single Great Lake, and there's one huge, you know, new inland sea.
It's just divide to continent.
That's right. And Jackson County becomes an independent state. Missouri becomes a seaport.
Yeah.
Cool.
Seaport. In fact, the best description of that is actually in a book called from Elaine Durham. She had a near-death experience, and she wrote about that. She actually sees that. Okay. She describes that. It's described in another book of that happening, in a book called There Is No Death by another near-death experience by Sarah Manet, M-E-N-E-T. Those are both still available on the online. So, then Russia's get wiped out. The tsunami, the big tsunami that comes in, an earthquake that takes care of San Francisco, Los Angeles, and everything else, pretty well takes a lot of the Chinese out. So they're no longer in major force as well. But the major thing that wipes out the Chinese is when the 10 tribes come back. And they come down along the Pacific from the piece of land lands up there. And that happens at the end of the Armageddon War. We haven't even talked about that. After the 13-month war, there's a period of time in here. We don't know how long. It appears maybe a couple of years. We don't know. And then we start another war, which is a 3.5-year war, which is most referred to as called the War of Armageddon or the Battle of Armageddon. And that's it. Whereas this war, 13-month war, does not start here. It actually starts in the Pacific, it appears. But it hits really hard in America. And that's kind of where it ends up centering is in America. The Armageddon War centers in Israel. And it's the whole world against little Israel.
And is the New Jerusalem established at that time?
Yeah, it's established during that time. While after the end of the 13-month war, somewhere around in here, okay, they go back, and after Russia's been destroyed, they start building the city of New Jerusalem, and people start coming to it whenever they can. At this time, the great false prophet pops up, and it gathers the rest of the world, and they appear to come against the New Jerusalem a couple of times. The great false prophet gathers the kingdoms of the world together, tries to march on New Jerusalem a couple of times, and is miraculously defeated because of the tremendous power of the inhabitants. I mean, it's an unbelievable place. And then they say, oh, the heck with them, let's go after the Jews. And so they then march against Jerusalem, and that starts the world. And that's the time of the kingdom of the beast. And so that's when they start slaughtering those who won't take the chip, primarily throughout the rest of the world. Okay. Meanwhile, the calls come out, leave Babylon, come to the city, and those who come, come. Okay. And then at the end of the Armageddon War, you have the two prophets, and you have the big earthquake, and you have the surviving Jews who are now purified. They go into the valley and meet the Savior, and they're converted to Jesus Christ.
Do you have a feeling for how many years between when we come down from the 10th city to when we're finally called to go back to the Jerusalem and start building that church?
I get a feeling it's very soon.
The same year?
Same year. That's my opinion. That's my opinion. But, you know, what do I know? Not much. I mean, I can prove it. yes.
I also heard there was another group that we'll have to do, and they were going to be doing missionary work.
Yeah, during that time, there will be, as Cleon pointed out, there is a big mistake in my book. I had put that the 10 tribes, I mean the 144,000 are called out somewhere just before the end of the Battle of Armageddon. I figured it was kind of like during the Battle of Armageddon, during the two prophets. And he pointed out, it can't be, because the Jews who have 12,000 in the 144,000 aren't converted until after the end of the Armageddon War. So a period of time for the 144,000 is still here. When the Savior comes and meets the Jews in the valley of created in the Mount of Olives, and they see him in red, and then he destroys the Armageddon army, and they become converted. Is that him coming to the world?
No.
How long between that period of time and before he comes to the whole world in power and great glory?
Generation.
We don't know. Okay, I asked Cleon about that, and he says, it's his guess, 7 years, and he gets that out of Ezekiel, where they're burying the weapons of war and stuff for 7 years. Okay. It could be 7 days. We talked and discussed it. It could be 7 days. It seems to be seven of something. 7 days, 7 months, or 7 years.
We looked up the council
It appears to be one of the very last things that happened just before the keys are turned over to the Savior. So it's probably one of the very, very last things just prior to the millennium starting the cleansing of the earth by fire. Okay. So my guess is somewhere, right into here. At the end of the Armageddon War. If this is the Armageddon. Okay. So during that time is the time of the 144,000 where everyone will get one last final chance to gather in or be destroyed. Okay, yes.
Have you read how long Christ will live here in America in Zion before the second coming?
No. Actually, what he says is that I'll be there, I'll visit, I'll walk his streets. Even during the millennium, he won't necessarily live here, but he'll visit it often. Okay? We're told that during the Zion, we'll have angels walk the streets. The people will become very similar to what's described in the Book of Mormon when the Savior is appearing to the Nephites after the destruction, type of the shadow, after the destruction there, he's appearing to the Nephites, and they're praying to him, and he turns white, and then they turn all white. Remember that? And his countenance shows upon them, and even the clothes turn white and glow. That's what the city appears to do like. The people who live there have been cleansed and purified. They follow the living prophet no matter what he said, even when it didn't make sense. And that's the key thing. You have to have a testimony of a living prophet. You need to have a testimony of a living prophet. He's going to ask you to do something. He's not going to tell you why. He's just going to say, do this. It's not going to be a commandment. It's going to be an invitation.
Oh, really? So when they tell you the 10 cities, it won't be, you're going to get destroyed this year if you're not up there. It's just like, I need to go up there, quit your job, take your storage.
Yeah.
It's going to be an invitation.
It's going to be an invitation. And because it won't be fit like that, most people will say, well, then I have my choice. And we always have our choice, right? They're going to say, well, I guess when things get really tough, then I'll leave. Things happen very, very fast. So if you Joe Smith said, when you have your chance to be invited to go, and you don't go, then Satan will have his way with you.
Why do you suppose they don't make it declared to him? We want all those who have the choice to
go. I'll give you an example. The gospel is a message of invitation. It's never a gospel of force. If you can't listen enough, and he who has to be commanded in all things is a what?
Well, then this invitation to read the Book of Mormon, really in this context, is a commandment.
When I was on my mission, I was taught that, if the mission president or the prophet said, jump, you started jumping, and then on the way up said, anybody know why?
Or how high?
Or how high. Let me know when I'm supposed to come down, okay?
So I know people in our ward who say, well, it's an invitation to the Book of Mormon, but they have all these excuses why they're doing it.
I think the great apostasy that's been talked about for the last days is in full progress now. Just hasn't happened physically. It's all spiritual. Okay? And this, do study in your own wards. How many people, is it me or is it getting hot here? How many people in your wards are doing what the prophet asked them to do? I believe there's a clear-cut reason for doing it. Okay? And,
always.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Before Katrina hit, the first presidency called up and said, we need 200,000 extra personal hygiene kits. We just begin making them. It was about 3 or 4 weeks before we can get. Okay? So Katrina hits. They have them shipped down. Okay? About 2 weeks after Katrina hit, he called up and said, we need a couple hundred thousand more. Okay? And then guess what hit? Rita and Wilma. Okay. So what does he know that he's not saying?
He knows.
Trust me. He knows exactly what's going on.
Well, that would explain why I'm only 10% of the lead, because I couldn't figure out how, if the problem was said, you know, for your safety, we are asking you to leave and leave now, and I can't believe that a good 50% would do that, but if it's an invitation, like...
You're planning on 3%.
I'll give you the best example I can think of, just quickly.
Yeah, well, in regards to your question, I mean, people right now do just the simple things that the church has to do.
Well, let's compare that to something as monumental.
Do I have to be writing in my journal to get to go?
Because I'm just saying that maybe it's not a stretch of imagination or maybe
you're
inviting me.
I'll give you a really good example from church history.
I believe it.
Okay. In fact, I wrote an article about this, and I call it we're getting set for a repeat of Hans Mill. Now, Hans Mill, according to the diary of Lee, who was witness to this conversation, Jacob Hahn came and argued that the prophet said, everybody gather in to Far West. Okay, the moms are out, but everyone gather in. As soon as that word came out, Jacob Hahn came in to Far West and argued with the prophet at least 3 times that we know of, maybe more, during that day. And basically he said, why? We have people out there, we're well armed, we're on good terms with the mobbers, we've got this new mill we just finished, we're pretty strong out there, we can defend ourselves, in fact, we'll take care of ourselves. And Joseph said, come in. If you don't come in, you may lose your lives. He says, Joseph, then if you want me in, then command me. I will not command you. I'm advising you and counseling you. If you want to save your lives, and actually he said this according to Lee, he said, if you want to save your lives, come in. Command me. Joseph said, no, I will not command you. If you want to come in, then come in. But I'm not going to command anything. Well, if you're not going to command me, then I'm going to not tell him to command. So they went off, and they didn't come in. They worked a little an agreement with the mobbers, and 3 days later, guess what happened? Mobbers broke it, massacred them. Okay? Now, Joseph, after Jacob left, Lee recorded that Joseph said, I'm not going to be a tyrant. It's not commandment. Even though it would save their lives. Okay? And so you have to understand that if you're not listening to the Spirit well enough to say, he's a prophet of God, he speaks this way, then, you got problems, other problems rather than just food storage. Yeah.
Thank you. I had an opportunity to be on Scalvin's home about 6 weeks ago, and he brought up that TNC 112 talking about
verses 24, 25, 26.
Yeah. Talks about, this day of vengeance and burning wrath, and that it would start in my house. Those who blaspheme my name in the temple. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Okay. He actually referenced that, President Hinckley did, in his October conference talk after the 9/11. Remember that very famous one? Was it Saturday morning or Sunday morning?
Was it the Vision of Joel? Sunday morning, Bill?
Sunday. Yeah. Okay. And so where he talked about that very thing, he quoted the first thing. And what's interesting is that in this, these three sections, and he even referenced it. He quoted the first verse, 24, and then he referenced it, and, to say, of all the things he could quote, talking about the last days, the events of the last days and destruction, why did he choose 112? Because there's only 3 verses in that whole chapter, the whole section, that talk anything about that. And it's not good for the members of the church. And so if you turn to that, you read that, what it says. He tells you who's going to get it, how it's going to come, and to who first.
Okay.
12, verses 24, 25, and 26.
You got to throw a glass at it.
Got your window. It goes in.
Oh, it's a kitchen bag.
Okay. All right, listen to this. Behold, vengeance cometh speedily upon the inhabitants of the earth. So how's it going to come? Speedily. Okay? A day of wrath, a day of burning. These are the words he actually quoted. A day of wrath, a day of burning, a day of desolation, of weeping, of mourning, and of lamentation. And as a whirlwind, it shall come upon all the face of the earth. So how's it going to come? Whirlwind. In fact. Now, here's who it's going to hit first. And upon my house shall it begin, and from my house shall it go forth, saith the Lord. First, in case you didn't understand that, he clarifies. First among those among you, saith the Lord, who have professed to know my name, and have not known me, and have blasphemed against me in the midst of my house, saith the Lord. Okay? Now, people say, well, if that really applies to us, how come they've never caught that? Go back to the Priesthood and Religious Society manuals with Joseph F. Smith, page 393. The chapter on the last day specifically talked about that, quoted him, where he said, this is going to happen to the members of the church. And he clarifies it even further than that. Just, you don't keep commandments when they happen. Okay? Well, the one other thing I need to put in here. Harold B. Lee had several quotes. President Benson quoted it, Spencer W. Kimball quoted it, but 1955, but basically it was this, that there will come a time that you will not be able to tell a friend or foe among the members of the church, and that members of the Quorum of the Twelve will be murdered because of their testimonies. Okay? President Benson referenced that, quoted part of that as well, several times. Okay?
Would you repeat that?
Yeah.
Harold B. Lee, 1955, meeting with the at BYU devotional. And Dave, and then Spencer W. Kimmel. I got all these quotes on my website. Spencer W. Kimmel quoted him, and Ezra Taft Benson quoted several times from this talk. And basically, it says that there will come a time that you will not be able to tell friend or foe among the members of the church, and that members of the Quorum of the Twelve will be killed or murdered because of their testimonies. Okay?
This desolation that starts with this. Are we talking before we leave, or is this
right after we leave?
This is right after we leave.
Yeah.
Okay. So
my guess is, right here, that's when the earthquake seems to hit. Within a couple months after we go up to the 10 cities, boom, that's when the earthquake hits and the flood hits. Now, it's interesting. If you're in a big earthquake, what kind of facility would you like to be in? Brick buildings?
Nope.
Or a tent?
It would be like out of the city first.
Yeah, out of the city.
Do they have
tents
up there now, or they've got
some lodges built up there? Yeah.
They have a tent facility.
They have
there
ice
in Silver right now.
Yes.
Yeah,
with
the girl.
Ice machine. They have ice dispenser and water. My question is about timing right now. I'm intrigued that new temples have been announced, and the church has announced this big, they're doing downtown. Also, my family is talking about establishing a farm. Is there time to do that kind of thing?
Don't know. Okay. Boy, K. Packer's a good one for this. The church always had two problems. You prepare for the second coming like it's tomorrow, and you prepare like it's 100 years away. Okay? And so the church will always go on and continue building programs and doing things along this line. But at the same time, having this inventory prepared just in case they have to pull it out, they're ready to go. Okay, along this line. And so they're prepared to implement Plan B or whatever you want to call it at a moment's notice when they need to. But otherwise, they plan straight ahead and go forth, because The Lord doesn't say it's going to happen at midnight at 2 o'clock, you know, on Sunday. Nobody knows the timing, okay, of these things. We know things are coming. And so he basically says, you know, get prepared on the one hand, but plant your cherry trees on the other. So it's the combination of the two. So we can't just say, great, we're going to run off to the hills and start living our communal camps right now because it's going to happen. There was a group, there are very few, there's quite a few groups who've done that. The most famous one is the Bo Grice group. Ran up to northern Idaho and stuff like that. And it's turned into a mess up there.
They didn't follow the prophet.
They didn't follow the prophet. In fact, he was totally warned and said, don't do this. Don't do this.
Talk something about the upcoming trucker strike before Thanksgiving.
I don't know anything about it. except that there is a rumor going around, I have not been able to verify it, that the independent truckers are planning to strike a few days before Thanksgiving and carry it all the way through Christmas and make a point about paying high gas prices.
Right, the gas prices are coming down a little bit.
Okay, so I don't know if it's coming. You know, the prices are, except on diesel fuel, it is on the gas fuel,
still high.
Yeah, it's still high. So I don't know. No one's been able to verify it. Anybody, independent truckers here?
I go for strike.
Have you heard?
4 days will do it.
Yeah. Now, I mean, how much, how much stuff is...
They did it in France about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
They put cops in front of the gas stations so the emergency vehicles could get gas.
Okay. How long would it take before the country shut down and the independent guys left?
I don't know. Independents are only 20%. But if all the truck stuff, it'd take 4 days.
Yeah, easily. And so it would have a big impact. But you haven't heard anything through them. Okay. I don't know. It could happen.
So no why the striking, that's actually a very local emotion.
Oh, I think it's very plausible. They've been eating it. You guys have been eating it for a long time. I talked to a trucker when my car burned up, and we sat in his cab while we watched the flames around the car, and we talked about things, and he was saying, he's been eating a lot of it. And he says, can't eat it very much longer. And so, some companies are giving it. I don't know what your deals are. They're paying for it.
It hurts.
Yeah. Laura?
I just need to say,
yeah, we need to call this quiz.
I think that the people are interpreting the government mandate to have a 72-hour get in and out of churches.
The church has never officially even said and recognized 72-hour kids. It's never been 72 hours. It's always been 1 year supply or more. It originally was 7, then it went to 5, then it went to 3, now it's to 1. Okay. During this year, by the way, there'll be times, months, when there'll be no sun at all. Because of the volcanoes and the smokes and all the stuff in the air. There will be no smoke, there will be no sun at all for months at a time.
There will be some wind, right?
Apparently. We don't know when that wind comes. The wind comes somewhere around here, so we don't know. Okay. We haven't even gotten the 10 tribes returning or anything else like that, but it's been fun.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I know it's getting late.
Any new stuff for us?
Next question. New stuff. The dreams, what's interesting is that about a month before Katrina hit, there were quite a few people on the board who were having dreams and visions saying something bad's going to happen in the Southeast. And then Katrina hit. And then after Katrina hit, the very next day or two, several people wrote in and says it's not over. There'll be in a couple more months before the season over, another one that hits the same Southeast side, and it did. Now they're saying that people are coming back and saying they're impressed is that California is the next place that's going to get hit.
With what?
Tsunami or earthquake or both?
They got hit yesterday.
What did they get yesterday?
The boat.
They deserve it, right?
They deserve it. Yes.
Other stuff. What else did he say?
Volcanoes up there.
volcanoes.
Fire.
All the stuff that we've talked about.
Do you anticipate that's after we come back down from the Ten Cities?
No, I think when things start going on, the best description is in Sermon A's book, where she kind of gets the whole, kind of an overview picture of things, and she says, you know, as things go bad, and just when you think it could get any worse, it does, and it does that several times. She says, you know, if something happens, and she doesn't know the exact order, because it was kind of fuzzy on the exact order, but she says, all of a sudden, there is no food. And there is no electricity, you know, and she saw the rioting in the cities. She saw people going in and grabbing televisions, and she said, and then she realized, why? Because there is no electricity was off. You know, they're booting electric, you know, there's no electricity anywhere on that. And then she'd seen the plague. It appears that the plague's hit first, and it's spreading, and the government kind of gets the idea that it's being helped or whatever, they got in control, but they really don't. And spreads everywhere. And then everyone tries to leave the big cities. Well, then it goes, dissolves into chaos. And then there is no more food. And then there is no more electricity. And then, when you think it can get worse, and then the winter hits early. And then when you think, oh man, there's no food, they're starving to death, they're freezing to death, stuff like that. Then we get, appears to get an attack, you know, we get earthquakes here and there. We have an attack on the United States, nuclear attack. And then the cities are on, because the cities are on fire, then we have a nuclear attack on the United States, and tactical stuff on this line. And then we have the invasion, and then we have volcanoes. Apparently the Madrid fault, when it goes, a whole lot of stuff goes off. Because there's still a lot of wicked people out there. And the volcanoes and everything goes off, and it gets worse. And that's when we come down, and then after we come down, it starts lighting up. She said, series of things, and you can't say, how are we going to survive next? And it gets worse. And how are we going to survive this? And it gets worse. And how are we going to survive this? And it gets worse. But she said, the miracle is, the Lord is with his people. Now, the rule of thumb is, if you follow the living prophet, first time without hesitation, you suffer little. If you still are righteous, but you try to follow a little bit later, you suffer more. If you are totally, you know, I'm not going to do this, whatever that, then usually you end up suffering quite a bit. Okay, people are going to say, well, I'd rather just not... I'm not going to prepare, I'm just going to figure I'm going to die. And my family's going to, you know, we're going to die with you. So I said, you know, my response to that is saying, so you're not going to have food stored, so you're going to stand there and watch your children die of starvation in front of your eyes because you were disobedient. And they said, oh, maybe I need to rethink this. Okay, you know, yes. Mentioned the same thing a couple times. Very powerful testimony of a living prophet from the Elder Faust. Anything else? Other questions?
What size is that carport? And what size is
it? It's 10 by 20.
Okay.
And the tarp is
50
by 60. It gives you a nice overhang all over the place.
I bought one of those, but it wasn't canvas. I don't know if you can get it in canvas. It's a vinyl.
Yeah, that's why you're
using the terrain, right?
Yeah, that's why you put the big heavy tarp over it to protect it. That'll give it at least 3 or 4 years. Okay.
Now, if there's going to be that big, huge earthquake that's going to have everything saying, now, all these people in Hebrew, they're only 2 miles away. But what's going to happen to them while that earthquake is going on down here?
They pick up, they you know, curse people who, you know, threw the tent on them, go out, pick up the tent, put it back up.
Chance are you getting a lot of fires.
There's a lot of shaking going on.
Yeah.
You know, regarding that, I read an account of the missionary, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. There was an account of missionaries who were staying in San Francisco.
Oh, really?
That didn't know that there was an earthquake. They woke up the next morning and they were fine and the city was destroyed around them. So why couldn't that same thing happen?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the temples will be protected miraculously while everything else is destroyed around them. Okay? There'll be some cleanup, I'm sure. There may be some cracked walls, some broken chandeliers, things like that, but there'll be some work to do. I might have to shovel some mud out, but we'll probably also be standing again.
I was just going to say.
This lady over here was talking.
before that, you will not be able to buy the supplies to get prepared. So the key is to get prepared now.
Well, we may be leaving before 2008.
That's correct.
And we'll still have the property purchased so that when we return, we can start building. Because the church always owns the property wherever they build.
My thing is, I'm just supposed to help you prepare a few more people, a little bit more preparation to get there. After that, it's not my problem anymore. Okay?
Well, one thing, too, that we always have to remember is that it's dependent upon the righteousness of the people. If, for some reason, the people suddenly choose to become righteous and repent of their sins, the timeline can change.
That's correct.
And it's numerous times in the scriptures that happens. And
they get a few more years.
Exactly.
And the good one, in fact, we just read through is where Nephi, you know, things become very wicked. And Nephi says, okay, famine. And then they become righteous. And, you know, wicked, most of the wicked die off. They come in. And then they become righteous. And then they turn right back. Within a few more years, they become wicked again, okay? Because they were almost forced to become righteous. And there's a story along with that between Elder Scowls and President Hinkins, but we won't get into that.
Today I
went
to order a phone for the warm clothes.
Uh-huh.
I can't get in there. The guy said come back in next month or in January.
She's saying about the phone. There is a guy that we know named Jen Phillips that has developed a super cold weather system that's good for 70 degrees below zero. It's fairly cheap to make, much cheaper than trying to buy the stuff, and you can actually live in the Arctic 24 hours a day. It dries itself out, stuff like that, and... he's telling people how to make it. He's putting together kits and
stuff.
Show
us your vest. Take your coat off. Take it all off. Have a vest on. It's lined with that foam.
Oh, cool.
And in the winter time, I don't care what temperature is, I wear my vest. I have three of them.
You don't feel warm if it's hot outside?
It's the temperature range on it is amazing.
It never gets warm.
During the time that I'm a Southern California beach kid, so before I moved to Montana, 65 degrees was bitter cold to me. Okay, and so when we moved up there, I met Jim, and so a friend of ours made these suits out of this stuff, pants and things, and I built my house with that. And so what was interesting, I could go out in the morning and the wind would be blowing and stuff like that, and it could be 10 degrees below zero or 10 degrees, whatever like this, and then I could come in for lunch, stand by the stove, and not have to take everything off, and the temperature range is just phenomenal. And it could be 10 degrees out, and then it would be 70 degrees or 50, you know, 80 degrees inside, and I still feel comfortable.
In this foam,
yeah. It's amazing.
Where's he get, what's it called?
It's regular foam. It's
tell us about it.
Okay, the padding under your carpet is the right kind of foam. The padding in your furniture is the right kind of foam. I tell people, I had a lady tell me that she would rather watch her children freeze to death than make them funny looking clothes. Jim says fashion is being warm no matter what you look like. But you just wrap yourself around it. You can do all kinds of things with
carpet foams.
You take your cushion and you unzip it and you put that foam in there. You stick your feet in there. It's going to keep you.
Yeah, the best stuff is you can go down the store and you find it right now. It's about a half inch thick?
I use half inch.
Half inch thick. And then you put this nylon stuff that they actually use for mesh garments. And you get that same kind of stuff because you want it close to you. It's like a second skin. It allows your skin to breathe, and the moisture wicks it away from your body, but keeps the heat in. And it's amazing stuff. One of the things he did was he jumped in, you know, it was 20 below zero, something like that. They chopped a foot of through ice. He jumps in the suit in the middle of winter on live TV. They said, whether you live or die, it's going to be a great story. You know, and so live TV jumps in. This is Minnesota or someplace like that. Jumps in.
It was cold.
He comes back out, then walks around for a half hour, and the suit dries itself out. And he sleeps out there in the night, and it works. It really works. It's amazing, amazing stuff.
It's been around. What's
Jim Phillips' email? What's his website?
I have his email and his website.
sure Jim's working in other places. I mean, that's just local because there's a lot of people now. We've been telling about it, so they're cleaning them out. So we will have to go some other places. All right, Tom?
Before we break up, I just want to know if we collect enough money to cover the rent.
Okay, if we, if good.
We just,
if not, my company, you right. I'm sorry, I haven't done this long enough. So this is my company shirt. This is how we're trying to earn money to prepare. We just put our national system up, so we want to grab some literature like that. Our big thing is that most people are paying $50 or $60 or $75 a month for phone bill. Now, if you like to stay with Quest, that's really great. But we can give you unlimited long distance, unlimited local calling, 17 features for $35 or free. If you refer people to us who sign up, we'll give you $5 a month off your phone bill forever, as long as they stay with the service. Refer 7 people, you have free phone service. And we're looking for new people to help sell it part-time. Pay good commissions on it. And we launched it 3 weeks ago. It's going crazy. And we have 3 divisions we have, and there's material back there you can talk about. So, in fact, I was with a company this morning that has a phone bill of $20,000. For businesses, we can cut their phone bill in half. We're going to be able to cut these guys from $20,000 down to around $10,000 or $11,000 a month.
Because how do you do this?
We use a system called Voice over IP, and we have our proprietary network, et cetera, along this line, or all the switches and stuff. So our system is rated at 95% quality, whereas people like Vonage are rated at 65%. So they, the businesses can't use them on this line. So there's materials back there. We pay commissions. We're now national. We can do it anywhere in the United States. We're concentrated here in the Western United States. So that's how our family is using it to get money, to save money, to put money aside. The nice thing is, you know, in about 6 months, you can basically start your own phone company. Local, regional, national, wherever you got friends or neighbors. And you can get people and set them up, and you can retire. That's the nice thing. Anyway, go back, grab some literature. It's kind of fun stuff, and it works. Any other questions? I'm temporarily living, the service center for our company is in Idaho Falls, and so I'm down there running that office right now. So I'm temporarily living in Rigby, Idaho. No, the email address is still the same, but I'm getting like 100 emails a day. It's this thing's going crazy, and so I'm trying to wear too many hats at the same time and kind of run like that. So it's kind of fun, kind of exciting.
Crash Light, would you say, was worth getting?
The little ones, we found the best to be these little ones, LED flashlights, and you can go to Walmart and buy them for $10 or $12. Have 2 or 3, the headlamps we found to be the best use. For actual work around at midnight when it's flowing, or you got to work with your hands, you put them on your hat, whatever, along this line. And they have 3 settings. They have a red light, they have a double LED, and it lasts forever. Some small batteries. Couple double A's. So what you do is you buy a little solar battery charger and, you know, a box of, you know, a little, you know, 24 of these things, and you got it probably for a year. Okay. You can also buy them so that you can put them on a little, like a little candle, you know, those light candles. You put one on there and then hang it from your and it'll light your whole place. Okay. It's, and then they're almost indestructible. So that works really great. That we have found. That's the best flashlights. They're small. They last forever on one of those little batteries. You can buy a lot of those batteries, and they're easy to charge up.
Those little
round batteries? Yeah. Well, the little AA. Triple, double A or triple A, whatever.
What about those batteries they're advertising on TV, you know, the infomercials, where it doesn't require a battery at all, and it has a lifetime.
Shake
them. Yeah.
The shaken ones? We're getting reports back from people who bought those. Now, the original ones were indestructible, but they were expensive, $25, $30. The new ones that are out that you can buy for like $6, $8, you get what you pay for, and they don't last very long. And then, but then nobody, see, they're betting on that nobody, it's not worth it to send it back.
Well, these are $20.
I don't know. So
yeah, you got to be careful. Some of the cheaper ones are being sold.
Yeah, so... just, you know, buy
buyer beware. The original ones were really good and strong and sturdy, but they were expensive. They were $25, $30. Now, so you need to just kind of.
Is this what you call freedom flashlight?
Probably something like that.
So I got one of those, you know what? You got a battery and you think you're getting shaking light and you're not. You're getting the battery. And I ran it down after 10 days. It took 10 days to get that LED, this total battery, totally go. Then I started shaking it to see what was truly coming from the shaking. 1 minute only gives me 2 minutes.
1 minute of shaking?
1 minute of shaking gives me 2 minutes of light. It was working off a capacitor. So it's false advertising. They give you the impression you're getting a strong beam from shaking. It's coming from a lithium battery they put in there. Yeah. They tell you there's no battery, but there is.
We haven't found those to be very good, so we never used any of them. Yeah.
Your website, I've looked at it, but it looks like a lot of the stuff's old.
Oh, okay. All right. So my website hasn't been changed in a year. The only thing that really is fun is when you go down to where it says members. Nothing else we don't care about, and it's kind of like, huh? You go down to members, you click on that, then you get into the fun stuff. It's members, and then you got message boards in there and stuff like that. The person who designed it for me, you know, didn't design it according to what I want, and then we fired them, and we've never changed it since then.
So that's active. That's everything that's going on there.
Yeah, you go to the members, and then once you click on, if you're a member, then you click on members, you give it a password, and whatever, you log in, and you're in. And then that's where it gets, you got the message boards, you got about 5 or 6 message boards, you got the virtual, you know, camping game and stuff, and you got a lot of fun pictures and things like that.
Doug Thompson.
Okay. Now what we ask is that we ask for $3 a month. You know, that helps keep a few things going. And hopefully we build up enough one day that we can actually have it revamped. Okay. Yeah.
We bought these solar lights at Costco that are pretty nice ones. You know, we figured if they sat out during the day, we'd take them in at 10
o'clock.
But if there's no sun.
Okay.
For a couple of minutes.
Yeah, so that's the problem. So you need to have some extra batteries.
There are some wind up.
What was that?
There's some wind up.
Yeah, we haven't had every time we bought a wind up battery or a wind up flashlight or radios like that, it's always broken within a month. And we don't use it that much.
I think so the best one you're saying is just buy some
rechargeable batteries or stuff like that. Yeah, and they last forever. They really do.
Up in Heber, on the main drag, there's a place that you can buy products, and it's on the west side of the road. Anyway, we bought a solar lantern, and it has a radio and weather channel.
Uh-huh.
And you put it out for a couple of hours, and it'll give you about 6 or 7 hours of light.
Yeah.
It runs around $100, but it will run up to a maximum of 18 hours, and it's good.
Oh, one other thing. Thank you. One other thing I need to tell about tents. You can't bring enough propane up, so what you need to do is for your tents, you need to get a little camp stove. You can look them on a little outfitter's camp stove. You know, maybe about 2 feet long, about 8 inches tall, about 10 inches, 12 inches wide, sits on 4 legs and have a 4-inch pipe up. You can cut a hole through it and, you know, use triple O pipe up through there. And you can get them for about $300, $200 or $300, depending what you can.
You can buy one at Harbor Freight. It's like the cast iron stove from the Harbor Freight for $100.
Okay. So you need something out of wood which to go inside your tent. The bell.
Something out of wood.
Huh?
You said out of wood.
Yeah, burns wood. Now I'm saying, you know, people say, well, I got a little propane stove. Well, that's really great, but it'll only last you a couple of weeks until you run out of propane. Unless you're hauling up on wheels a 1,000-gallon propane tank. Okay, which is not advisable. Okay. Other little things. Lots of little tricks and things that we've learned. We've had a lot of good discussions on the board, and that's what we discussed, that kind of stuff. Plus the food a lot. Yeah.
You know, we talked about this tent. Respect, you know, but then you turn around and say they'll have tents for us.
Yeah, but we're saying
the lazy guy I am. Maybe I'm going with the bare minimum here.
Oh, okay, so, that's fine.
So help me understand why
their tents
and treat that tent if they're going to have a tent.
Well, because they're going to give you an 8x6 tent, you know, that's not insulated, there's no floor on it, and there's probably no heat in it. So, you'll get the bare minimum. Yeah, what you do is you get a piece of plastic for the floor. You can get a 6 mil plastic or whatever along this line, a little bit thicker plastic if you want, and then go to a carpet store or an old carpet place and haul some stuff away. And so you lay the plastic down so that it goes like this, inside to inside, or in like this, and you kind of mound it here along the outside like that. And you put your carpet here. And as Dave, we chatted when I were talking the other day, he said, you know, if you put your cots on the outside, then you really only need carpet here. And it's really nice to have a little bit of insulation on your feet when you get up in the morning and the ground is frozen.
Can you let us have that kind of disparity in
the field? Sure. This is not...
Great hard feelings.
It's not communism.
Yeah, this is not communism.
You had a choice.
This is, you know, you had a choice and you were prepared early. Okay? That's right, good point.
What about ventilation on that tent?
There's lots of places you can open it up because the tent has openings here and here and along the wall. Okay, that's why you would, if you want, you put the foil around it, then you can cut holes and with Velcro open it up and then Velcro close it along this line. So there's lots of little options you can do. Just become imaginative.
What about portability?
Well, that's the nice thing about this one is that you can easily take the tent, the carport, and the metal and stuff comes in two boxes about 6 feet long, this wide, this tall, and, you know, about 40 pounds, 50 pounds, two boxes that way. Easily haul away. You haul one of those army tents, and you need a full-size truck to haul that puppy around. This you can put up, because I've done it, takes about 2 hours to put up the most. You know, one, if you have help and you kind of have done it before. And you can easily fold it, take it to gown, all the insulation, everything else like that, put it, you know, and easily haul it away.
And all the dreams, visions, whatever that you have heard about, is there any situation where we're going to one place and then we're picking up and going to another place?
Yes.
And picking up and going to a third place?
The people back east, it appears, have that problem. There was a dream we call the Texas dream, a Texas bishop's dream, where he literally saw these are appears to be the group of people who didn't leave when they first had a chance. They will be with you in a week or two. Well, then things happen, and a week becomes 2 weeks and 3 weeks. And so as they make their way across, they go to one place, gather a few more people, and then they go. And by the time it takes them about 6 months before they finally end up with here, and by the fourth month, they're finding their way back. Through the mobs and stuff like that. But as they stragglers join them, stuff like that. It's a very interesting dream. Now, I'm in the process of trying to put together a book. It's going to be called, never guess the title, Dreams and Visions of the Last Days. And in fact, we tested on the first half of it's finished, and we just tested it yesterday out for printing. And as soon as I get back home, I'll check it. Kind of stuff. So hopefully have it out here in a little bit. It'll be real cheap, be $5 or $6.
One person that I know of.
It's possible.
Water filters.
Yeah, water filters are, you gotta have them. The best, you know, both kinds of little portable ones you can put in your backpack and just haul around, whatever, like this. Or the big, you know, 3 gallon, 5 gallon ones you put one on top of the stack up that way. Really good stuff to have. In some of the dreams, they have those who have the water purifiers just poured in, and that's great. Everybody else has to boil it for an hour. Okay.
So when they pull up this truck, there's got to be limited space. You get so many cubic feet for your stuff. What if you've been preparing so much you can fill the semi yourself?
I know people who have 7 years of supplies of food, plus a whole greenhouse and a metal shop, because they've had dreams and visions about that. and of Woodley as well.
And the crew will move all of it?
Well, no. He's prepared himself to move most of it. He said, the Jews take my food, I'll bring the rest of it up. There's a group up at Cache Valley that have gotten together, and as they evaluated the best things to get, they actually went out and decided that the best ways to go, they talked about semi-trucks, but you got to get a license for that. So they went out and found these surplus buses, school buses. And then they, you know, took out about half the seats, worked on the engine so they'd actually run, and stuff like that, put a trailer hitch in the back so they could put a whole lot of stuff on top, underneath, inside, and a big trailer behind it as well.
I thought you said the church would provide the transportation to get stuff up.
Oh, yeah, but these guys are independent guys, and they're bringing a heck of a lot more than they think the church is going to charge.
So for the average Latter-day Saint, who's just needing the call to go, it'll be the church supplying the semi-truck.
Yes.
Won't there be limited space on there? You say, well, I'd like to take my bed, and I'd like to take this,
and
I'd like to take that.
They'll give you a list of things that you can bring that they will haul, and the rest you have to haul.
Think you let us take this kind of tent?
Sure.
Okay. Take it yourself. They don't want to take food. So the dreams only talk about taking food stores.
Yeah. I imagine if you say, I have a tent, because they also, one of the dreams talks about a table, a chair for each member of the family, a bookshelf. You're encouraged to take a laptop computer
that
if you have them.
Location specific,
yeah,
it could
be.
The same.
Well, that makes sense. If you're sitting in a tent, you ought to have some kind of a table and a chair and a bookshelf. You're encouraged to bring your temple recommends, your temple clothing, because some of the dreams, in fact, from children, are that they're going to put tents and designate them as temples in the tent cities. And so they'll be doing that. So that's why, you know, interestingly enough, that's why they encourage everyone to get your own clothing and 2-year temple recommends. Isn't that interesting? Another one of those things, okay? So all sorts of fun things, and I'll think it through. Okay? Any other questions? Come on, guys. I'm getting tired, aren't you?
No.
Well, you probably need to get on the road.
Well, no, I just, I'm staying at my brother's house, and he got tired. He went home, so I'm going to follow him. He just lives up in Riverton. Yes?
Okay, you have the water up to Lake Bonneville level versus the 1,500 feet thing.
Right.
How do we resolve that discrepancy? And if it is up to 5,500 feet of sea level and all that stuff, how about the Salt Lake Temple and things like that, Jordan Temple and Kevin Owens Temple?
I don't know. I guess we're going to have a lot of mud to clean out.
Okay, how do we resolve the Salt Lake Temple then? Or is this 5,500 feet high, a bunch of baloney, and it's only going to be the 1,500 foot wave you talk about?
I don't know. I haven't seen those visions.
At Katrina,
have a place, and we ought to have a couple of TVs and turn them on and watch the news and stuff like that. And and, you know, and be able to coordinate some stuff. So we have communication equipment, say the equipment's down, something like that. So they put like, you know, $500 together and did that kind of stuff, bought a couple of TVs and stuff. And so great. Then what happened was that they put it up the chain of command, and somebody, the presiding bishopric, says, that's a pretty good idea. I'd like to, when you do that, I'd like to come see. Oh, all right, well, now we better give it a couple of grand and buy better TVs, and maybe we better scrounge around. If they're going to come, maybe we better have some communication equipment, computers. So we went and raided, you know, the throw-out laptops, and that's where I became involved. I said, now we need to network them together and do emails. So that's where I was called in to do that for them. And so, okay, so we can have laptops for that. Well, it went to the Forum of the 12, and guess what somebody said there? I'd like to participate when you do that. Oh, boy. All right, now we put 10 grand to it. And you know, and we could barely get some of these laptops, you know, working. You know, this one doesn't work at all. This one almost works. We can use that. And it's like this. Well, it finally hit the first presidency, you know, like that. And by the time it hit the first presidency, now we're talking about $25,000 budget. We're having four televisions. They're all big color TVs. We're now planning to have a place, so a full emergency operations center for the first presidency, the presidency of the Quorum of the 12, the presiding bishopric, and the managing directors of the church. So all linked together, satellite telephone up and down so we can communicate with the banks, the whole bit along this line, all emails so we can tie in everywhere the church. So it finally gets the president, so we set it all up so we can say, okay, we designed it now, and maybe next year we'll put up the budget to buy real laptops rather than, we've found better quality ones now. They did a study of where the best building to put this in case of an earthquake, and that was in the genealogical building, because it's actually supposed to be a five-story building. It's only three. So it's actually the best building. And so we did that. Well, we did a study around, and when they built it, they were doing the construction on the conference center, we actually said, do we want to put it there? And the response, and it went off the chain, and it came back from President Hinckley, no, it's not going to be in Salt Lake Valley. Because we were saying, well, we need you got to understand, when they built the conference center, there's more steel and concrete than anything. I mean, it's built to withstand almost any kind of earthquake you can figure. Okay? But, so he got the, President Hinckley got hold of the plan, said, we'd like to participate. And he says, now he says, this is all well and good. He saw the plan, and we pretty well said, well, we're prepared for that for about a week. And he said, you better prepare for about at least 3 months. Some more cans of beans, and we added porta potties and the whole thing. So the whole system was designed so that in 24-hour notice or less, we could literally take those, you know, two or three trucks and stuff, zip anywhere, and in 24 hours set up church headquarters and be back in operation again anywhere. That could be. We could go to the desert. We had generators. We had fuel. We had all that kind of stuff ready to go. Little side note story. One of the guys told me, he said they had in this in the truck the communication equipment, satellite phones, GPS stuff, all this communication equipment. Well, when they the first presidency prior to the hurricane season, for whatever reason, there was about 14 trailer semi-trucks that they sent down. Most of those, 11 of those, were already pre-positioned down in the south. But they sent three from here, one full of tents, one full of kits, personal hygiene kits, and one full of communication gear. Okay? And so they sent the truck down there. When it got down there, of course, here's FEMA opening the trucks to see, what do you got there? Well, this is for our people like this. The FEMA confiscated our communications truck. Took it. Said, we don't have this kind of stuff. This is good stuff. Thanks. And so they actually had to send somebody else down in the trunk of his car with some communication equipment for the state presidents and stuff to communicate along this line. So I don't think they're going to do that one again. It couldn't hurt. Might help. You know, first things first. We have a kind of an order of suggestion. We say, you know, bare bones food storage, and then, you know, but you're going to eat a lot of wheat. You're going to get awfully tired of wheat mush. You only eat it 47 ways. And so, sprouted, not sprouted, you know, this, like this. So the next level, after you have your basic supplies, we say add variety to it. Add different kinds of grains, different kinds of flavorings, a lot of seasonings, things along these lines. Variety will make life a lot more pleasant. You know, the first level you may survive, but you're not going to be happy. The second level, you know, the third level is prepare for in case you have to leave your house for whatever reason, because of a flood, earthquake, you know, it could be a plague, whatever along this line, or you can divide it out. So you might have to, if you have your family, even if it was in your backyard, live for a year over a winter in a tent. What happens if your house has a crack and they won't let you go in it? Because of the earthquake potential damage. Happens all the time. Okay? So what are you going to do? So that's the next level of preparation, is prepare for that kind of living. That's another whole step beyond just saying, okay, I can survive, I got the bare bones. The level beyond that is saying, okay, be a help to those around you. If you have skills with carpentry, you might bring a lot of carpentry tools and stuff like that. Be good at woodworking things. If you have skills at midwifery or herbals and things like that, bring all that kind of stuff up. Like I said, I know people who've got complete machine shops ready to go. They can make anything that needs to go. And so they have it in a vehicle, you know, so they can just haul up a trailer.
Is it law of consecration in these 10 cities, or do we have stewardship over our own things? And it's up to
It appears that we have stewardship over our own things, but it appears to be a lot of sharing back and forth. I'll trade you two cans of beans for cans of rum, you know, for a thing of ice, whatever. The things
they won't force us to just donate it to one big pot.
No. Not one. In fact, I used to think that. I'd say, well, okay, we're going to go up and live the consecration. No, it appears that we do not. But there's a lot of potlucks, which is almost close.
Okay, there's goodwill going on, but nobody takes it away from
them. Yeah, there appear in some of the dreams and visions of people teaching them, so they don't even know how to boil water. And so they said, well, how do I fix wheat? And then others who have had it are doing classes and teaching and stuff like that. There's a lot of teaching going on.
I have very little wheat because I will trade you. You give me two buckets of wheat, I will give you one bucket of grain mix to add to your wheat.
Yeah. Another thing that would be good for trading is a bucket of mini Snickers, trust me.
I had one last
year. We've done it.
Yeah. No. Let's see. You chop this wood for me, here's a mini Snickers. 2 hours worth of work, it's worth it.
What's your feeling on those of us that have a business? A couple of days notice, you don't have time to wind down a business.
Trust me, I
have people hanging.
That's the key thing. Gone fishing, plop, sorry, be back in 6 months, maybe. I don't know. It comes down to, you know, that's really the pull of the world versus the, you know, you've heard the story about Noah's cousin Jeremiah, right? You've heard the story about Jeremiah? Come on. All right, well, Jeremiah was Noah's cousin, you know, the day before the flood. And so one day, Jeremiah is in his shop, okay, and he's like this door, and all of a sudden he hears the voice saying, Jeremiah, go see your brother Noah. Okay. I'll do that. I hear, I obey. So as he says, I'm going to close the shop and walk home, you know, and Noah is, you know, 2 day journey from where he lives. And so, you know, occasionally he'd been out there and helping Noah with the ark and stuff like that. He said, you know, I'm busy, so he gives him all the fun. Anyway, so he said, great. But just as he's ready to walk out, his number one customer walks in the door. So he steps like that and says, okay. So he starts dealing with that and two other customers. It happens to be, comes out the busiest day. So at the end of the day, finally turns up shop, goes home, stuff like that. And on the way home, he says, oh, forgot all about it. I got to tell my wife. So he gets home like this, and he says, listen, dear, had an angel come to me and said, we got to go see our cousin Noah. And says, we need to leave in the morning. And she says, leave in the morning? Are you kidding? Tomorrow's the biggest day of the year. I've got this big social we've been planning all month long, all year long. He says, we can't do that. I said, listen, we'll do the social, and then we'll leave immediately after the social. Okay, all right. So they have the big social. They found the big party. They have, you know, the big socialite kind of thing like this. They call that kind of stuff. And he says, well, congratulations, I'm too tired. In the morning. Well, they get up in the morning, and it's raining, and they said, it's too, you know, we'll, as soon as it stops raining, we'll leave. So you don't hear much about Jeremiah. Okay. So that's, you got to have enough faith to say the prophet says, like Lehi, drop everything and run. Lehi went ahead.
Well, I just wanted to have that square with, not leaving in haste.
Okay, with all things prepared. The church is preparing things, and if you haven't prepared. So, in haste, if you look further in the Doctrine and Covenants, it says in haste, so there be not plagues and disasters and stuff like that. But if you're prepared and the camp's prepared, it's not in haste. It's a planned retreat, a prepared retreat. It's not like you're fleeing for your lives. So, I don't know. Yeah.
Somebody talked about scenario 3 is quakes in the Wasatch Front. Maybe talk about that one. A lighter one in the spring, another one in September, October, and then really biggie.
That was me.
That was you.
Yeah.
You only talked about one here.
I know, the big one.
Can you kind of
said there was a series of quakes.
When we're called out.
I'll tell you the dream where it came from, is related to me. He said the first one, he's a traveling sales guy. And he says in his dream it was very strange because he saw this earthquake and this was 15 years ago, before the freeways were, and stuff like that. And so he said, as the earth first earthquake down, it dropped all these interchanges. And he says, it's strange because he says it looked like it was Los Angeles, but it was Salt Lake City, but it had the freeway, spaghetti bowl and stuff like that. And so he says, when it dropped them down, it was bad, but it wasn't terrible. And they cleaned up the mess, and just about the time they got, and this is sometime in the spring, just about the time they got the mess cleaned up, and kind of things rebuilt, about 4, 5, 6 months later, it happened again. And so it sank out about the same thing, maybe a 6 on the scales like that. They dropped a few places. They cleaned that up. He says, I can remember that because I couldn't get from one place easily because the freeways were down, damaged. That's what he remembered distinctly in his dream. He says, and then, not long after this, much in a shorter period of time, like a month or so, in the fall, late summer, early fall like this, then a really big one hit, and that destroyed everything.
Do you have other supporting dreams of the three earthquake scenarios?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, where are we when the first one hits? Are we in tent cities? Are we still... That happened in the spring that we're called out, right? The tent city. Yeah. Didn't you say that?
Yeah. And so my guess, and I don't know the answer to that, my guess is we might be there already. And so, it would make sense to me that we leave, it happens, and everybody says, you guys left, and it was no big deal. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Okay. So, and we might have people up there say, well, we missed that one. Let's go back.
So you think we might miss all three?
Yeah, we might be gone for all three. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. That's a guess.
How much support, though, of the three earthquakes?
Couple.
Just a couple. Yeah. How much support do you have for a gigantic earthquake?
Lots. Lots. Yeah, but that's referring to the big earthquake at the end of the Armageddon War. In fact, Orson Pratt said that's the earthquake that's caused by the city of Enoch returning and the ten tribes returning up in the north. And it causes the continents going back together. And that's where it knocks the earth out of orbit, straightens it up, and that's why the heavens seem to fly or flee as, deer chase, because we're out of orbit now. Okay. Lots of fun.
Is that happens way after?
That's at the end of the Armageddon battle, Okay, that's when all things are in motion.
Is there any information that we might be in the 10 cities longer than a year?
Some people seem to think so. Okay. Some people say longer. So my reason I say a year is because we've, they're pretty adamant about a year supply. Now, if it's longer than that, then...
But
I have to do manna from heaven.
But it says
minimum
of 1 year.
I would say minimum of 1 year. After that, it's something Heavenly Father.
Elk.
Okay. Yes.
Have you had any impressions about the bird flu, or has anyone had any?
No, I haven't. You have to understand that now we're getting into Gadian side stuff. Are there Gadian secret societies throughout the world and in the United America? Beyond the shadow of a doubt. You had a living prophet swear to it. Several times, testified to it several times. Okay? In general conference. President Benson.
Yeah.
Okay? And, up and down, and that's it. And that was how long ago? 89? 88.
89.
Yeah, and so It's 10 times worse now.
And what's that have to do with bird flu? Why did she put that up?
Well, bird flu is man-made.
Okay.
So was AIDS. So is most everything else.
Biologicals, yeah.
Yeah. So.
I got an email today that talked about a bill before Congress that is going to mandate that you have to have the vaccines.
Okay. They don't need it.
Chris, I called Senator Hatch's office, and the person who answered the phone, I said, I would like to vote that Senator Hatch votes against this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy argued with me. He said, well, this is needed. This is needed.
Oh, yeah. We have to understand, when the chip comes out, people will stand in line cheering for it, saying, me first.
Yeah.
Fighting over who's going to get the chip first, because it'll be so convenient, so easy. And so, you know.
What it'll be is to keep other people from taking their fair share of a very limited
supply. Oh, they've done a good job of setting that up, haven't they?
Yeah.
Because they were saying, well, we hope to have enough, so first, you know, people like this, so, hey, I want to get mine first or whatever. So, and it's, they really don't need the bill, okay, because the Homeland Security bill has given, has given the President of the United States and every governor of every state the full legal right. All they have to say is, we believe there is an emergency, health emergency, and we're now mandating forced inoculations. They don't need us another bill. That's just for show. They can just declare immediately and say, boom, you got it, and that's over.
But we don't want these forced. We don't want these forced inoculations.
No.
It's bad. What are they doing to us?
They can put anything they want to
in. You know, they're still putting mercury in most inoculations like that, and flus and stuff.
So is it insidious? Is it on purpose to kill the population?
Yeah.
Yep.
Of course.
You know, we're overpopulated. You have
to. Yeah, I know the Rockefellers and the Illuminati want to get us down to 500 million.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they've actually published ways to do that. First, you try this, you know, like AIDS or whatever, get rid of the undesirables, the unproductive people, then you get rid of the troublemakers. Americans are mostly considered troublemakers. Okay, they're too independent to work in a good, cohesive society. They've been brainwashed about this freedom thing and stuff. So, you know, it goes on and on and on. And they're real.
Go for syndrome. This is like 500,000, 700,000.
Oh, yeah. Including the ones who never went. They just got the inoculation.
The anthrax.
Yeah.
Well, it's like who gave AIDS to Africa?
Yeah.
The UN, yeah, beyond the doubt.
World Health Organization.
Yeah, World Health. Okay, anything else? Well, thank you for coming. We'll probably be doing this again sometime. We'll let you know. Bring a friend. Get a few more people so you don't have to share.